And welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 358. We're live tonight on Odyssey, Rumble, DLive and Entropy. Please do share the links wherever you're watching it. It really, really helps. And I have to say this every week, but it really helps. When you're not on X, when you're locked out, when you're one of the people that isn't allowed on social media, it really hurts your reach, which is why they do it. If you can help me by sharing it, we've got a great guest and a great show coming up. I've also been really busy. Last week, you will have seen the excellent demo we did in Nuneaton. That was great. There is a review of that up on my channel. Wherever you are watching my content, you can see the review of that. I'm one of the few people who's active in real life as well as producing content, so please bear that in mind. Also, I've got a lot of things coming up later this week. I'm back on the David Duke Show on Thursday after taking a short hiatus. I am also producing a video for Friday. I've not done a scripted video for a while, but there was something that came up that wouldn't really have been suitable for a stream, and I wanted to do a scripted video. I hope you guys like it. It's been a while since I've done one of those. They take a lot of effort. I've been scripting it out today. Going to get that produced. I might do it as a premiere, though, so when I launch it, it goes live in multiple places at multiple times, so that rather than it just being a video that gets uploaded, it's like a premiere. It's only going to be about 10, 15 minutes long, but I hope everyone likes it. Put quite a bit of effort into making it informative, short, and the kind of thing that you'll be able to share. We won't be doing any stream on Sunday. We were going to do the A-Team on Sunday with Sam Melia returning, but unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, it just is Easter Sunday this weekend. So we're not going to be doing a stream on Easter Sunday because I'm sure most people will be with their families. Most people will be spending time with their loved ones, having a nice lamb roast and all of that. And they probably don't want to do a stream on Sunday. And also, I should imagine that many of the people that I do those streams with will be busy Sunday night with their family and won't want them sort of peeling off to do a stream. But we'll be back to normal programming the week after. So I will be doing other streams this week, but this will be the only stream I'll be doing on my channel. The other will be a pre-recorded video, which will hopefully be a premiere. So moving forward from that, if you want to contribute to my work, it would be massively appreciated. I can't do this without your help. I can't keep going without your help. That's just the way it is. If you appreciate my work, please do consider giving a donation. You can do so via Entropy or directly through Rumble. Everything is gratefully received. I've never put anything behind a paywall. I've never, ever taken a wage formally from a Patriotic Alternative. Never. So everything I receive on these streams is what I live off. And that means, you know, if you help me out, it means the world to me. So please do consider giving a small donation or more if you can afford it. Obviously, we will read out any donations in the second half of the show, and any questions will be answered by me and Blair. You can also donate by cryptocurrency. All the crypto links are in the description below. And if you're watching this on replay, please don't be shy. Make a donation via Entropy or Rumble when I'm not online. You know, we have over the course of the show, a couple of thousand people probably dip in and out of the stream watching live. But when it comes to the replay, many, many more people watch it on replay. And if you are one of those people who watches on replay every week and enjoy it, please do consider giving something. You can also write to me if you need my help at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. And I'm always here if you need me. Anyway, we've got an amazing guest on the show tonight. I'm lucky enough to have met this man in person. He's a good friend of mine. We do talk and correspond when we're not streaming. He's not somebody I just message out of the blue saying, do a stream. We do talk to each other. And I really like being in his company, actually. He's one of those people that I've met offline, met in the real world. And he's an amazing guy. And he really is the kind of person that you should look up to, you should support, because he is the real deal. He's a true gentleman in the real world as much as he is on stream, and he is someone you can look up to. He is intelligent, he keeps himself in good shape, and he helps young men overcome the problems of obesity, inactivity and low testosterone by helping them get in shape, designing them fitness plans. And these things are super important because they help boost people's confidence, which help them get on in life where they need to be. This guy is a hero of our people, and he's living in one of the most oppressive nations in the world. Blair, how are you doing, my friend? It's good to have you back. It's been a while. I hope you've been well.
I'm doing great, mate. Thanks for the warm welcome, as always. And it's good to be back. It's been a little while since our last catch up, our last live catch up. And I think it's been a few months since I've done a live stream as well. The last one I did would have been by myself. But then prior to that, I would regularly stream with my colleague, Joel Davis, who on that point, he's got a Supreme Court bail hearing today. So Joel's going for bail today. If you don't know who Joel is, Joel is a close colleague of mine and an activist known for public demonstrations, public speeches, and streaming down here in Australia. He's an Australian nationalist, very active, very aggressive, and quickly became very popular over the last couple of years. But because of a Telegram post allegedly threatening a politician, Joel's been in jail. He hasn't been found guilty of anything, but they've held him anyway. And they've stacked a lot of other charges on him while he's been in jail, all in relation to quote-unquote hate speech. So when Mark says this is one of the most oppressive nations, Australia, my country, is one of the most oppressive nations right now, I'm sure he's referring to that, among other things. But Joel's going for bail today, and he should get it, I think. I'd be very surprised if the Supreme Court didn't grant him bail. So if you do know who Joel is and you have supported him, thanks very much. But if you don't and you're looking for more information, I'll send a link to Mark and he can maybe share it with you guys in the comments. But that's the most pressing part of news for Australia for today.
How's he holding up? Is he still in good spirits? Because I know that jail affects different people, you know, in a different way. And there's some people who go through the system and they come out of jail and they're like, well, it wasn't too bad. I met loads of cool people. I've got friends. I was popular on the wing. And there's other people who have a tough time and they can't cope with being in there. They get into confrontations. There's other things that go wrong for them. And they just find it very, very difficult. How is Joel dealing with his time inside?
Very well, I think, especially considering that when he was arrested, his girlfriend was pregnant with his first child. And a few days after he was arrested, she was heavily pregnant, she gave birth to their first son. His boy is very healthy. Joel hasn't actually been able to spend a lot of time with, I think he's had one visit officially. He's been in prison for 4 months. And because of his status as a high-profile offender, but because of the nature of his offending, because of his politics, basically because of his ideology, Mark, let's be honest, he's being classified as a national security risk or threat. And that means he goes in isolation. He doesn't get a lot of contact with any people except a select few. He wasn't even given a Bible or access to a lawyer for a couple of weeks. It took them weeks to get a lawyer back onto his phone list. He's being kept in pretty low conditions, pretty harsh conditions. But considering all of that, considering that he's sitting in jail thinking, God, my girlfriend just had my son and I can't even hold him, considering that, he's holding up pretty well. I've spoken to him probably over a dozen times. He isn't able to call me anymore, though. For some reason, they just took me off his phone list and they didn't explain why. Initially, they didn't explain why, and then they said it's because of your national security classification. You're not allowed to talk to that person. But look, I'm hoping that he's released today. I was hoping to get up because he's in another state in Australia to me, and Australia is a big country. I was hoping to travel up there to be there for him today, but I'm not going to be able to make it. But I'm sure a lot of the boys up there will be waiting for him at the front of the Supreme Court, and it's going to be great to have him out. I'm pretty confident he will get bail. I'll be really shocked if he doesn't. If he doesn't, it just demonstrates that the courts, the judges, could be compromised all the way up to Supreme Court. And if that's the case, that's really shocking. And the reason it's so shocking,
it wouldn't shock me, bail,
just so you guys understand the situation, the charge that Joel is being held for is menacing or harassing someone through a carriage service, you know, mentioning someone in an online post. It was only one post, okay? It wasn't actually proven to have caused any harassment or, you know, resulted in any damages. That charge is a pretty low-tier offense and doesn't usually result in a term of imprisonment even when convicted, even when found guilty, it's got a less than 6.5% rate of imprisonment. That means almost 95% of people who get charged with this never even go to jail. They get bail, they go to court, they might get a fine, that's it. Joel is being held without being proven guilty and has been held in a maximum security facility as classified as a national security threat for the last 4 months, hasn't been able to have access to basic rights that other prisoners get access to. And the irony is he was arrested in the same suburb where our worst terror attack in the nation's history just took place late last year, the Bondi shooting, where a couple of Muslim characters targeted some people on a beach, specifically trying to target Jewish people. That terrorist has literally had access to more rights than Joel. He's had access to an imam inside the prison, which is like the, you guys probably know this, it's like our version of a priest. He's been given a Quran, which is like our version of a Bible. He's been able to contact friends and family. Joel's had none of that, okay? Joel wasn't given access to a priest. He wasn't given a Bible. He wasn't able to call his friends and family. He wasn't even given access to a lawyer for a while there, all because of his national security classification. So that's the situation. I'm hoping to see him out today, though. He should get bail today.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't. And I'm not saying that because I want to depress anybody. I'm saying it because it's just the way I see things. You know, I watch one of my best friends go to jail for stickers that the police said, well, the stickers were legal. We are not going to argue the truth of any of them because as far as we can see, they were truthful. But we think they were intended to stir racial hatred. Obviously, that's Sam Melia. I just find that if they want to screw you, they will screw you. And it's cases like the Rob Rondo case. I mean, Rob Rondo punched a guy, you know, on a campus somewhere. Well, okay, punching a guy on a campus, what's that? 3 months in jail, you know, a fine. Well, they chased him halfway across the world and deported him on a private jet with a bag over his head, as if he was Osama bin Laden's right-hand man, for just sticking it on some lefty at a demo. And I sometimes wonder, you know, when we talk about cruelty and police brutality, when the police and the system go for us, they go for us in a way that they would never go for any other group or have gone for any other group. And I mean, if somebody wants to point out, like, there's another group that have experienced this kind of prejudice, this kind of extreme level of sentencing, this kind of extreme level of persecution, I don't know. I've never heard of it. I mean, you know that there are groups in America, left-wing groups, that committed crimes, horrendous crimes, acts of terrorism. They were all allowed to leave jail and came out and became college and university lecturers and wrote books and became phenomenally wealthy because of their crimes. There are people out there in this country who are serious Muslim terrorists, and there are essentially state-funded groups that are there to work out ways to ensure these men get out early. And, you know, they all appear to be reformed. Whereas with us, you know, you might as well just lock us up and throw away the key. And when people like Sam Melia came out of jail, one of the worst things for him is they were like, well, you can come out of jail, but you can't go and live with your family. You've got to go and live in a hostel. And, you know, you've got to be back in the hostel for 7 p.m. every night. You can't even put your kids to bed. And I sometimes wonder, you know, the people behind this, they must be the most soulless, wicked people imaginable. And what they've done to Joel is arguably, and from what you're saying, you know, I would argue this point, is actually worse than what they've done to Sam, because at least Sam got regular visitation and at least Sam was allowed to move freely in general population, made friends, got a job in prison. It seems with Joel, they're doing everything they can to break his spirit. I just hope that when he does come out, somehow you guys manage to give him some incredible warm welcome.
How is Sam going? Have you been, I didn't actually catch the stream that you did with him or the show that you did
with him. He's doing really well. His book became a number one bestseller on Amazon. He's doing really, really well. He's knocking it out of the park. He feels really good about everything. You know, obviously he's been back with his family now for some time. He's back at protests. He's back giving speeches. He's an incredible guy. And I am so, so pleased that he's come out this the other side. And if anything, it's made him stronger and more sort of dedicated in terms of his love for the system. I'm sure that'll do that for Joel as well. I mean, you know probably Joel better than anyone. How do you think he'll react when he gets out?
I think he'll be very glad. The first time you go to jail for whatever reason, I've been a long time ago when I was a young scamp, the first time they release you, the first thing you notice is how green everything is, because you don't see trees or grass, especially not in Australian prison. Everything's just concrete, and you don't see the horizon. There's just this huge concrete wall on the outside of your field of vision. So the size, the scale of society, of the world, and how green it is, you start to really take all that in and you appreciate everything. So it's going to be an experience for him. Joel's very good at sort of coldly experiencing reality, though. Joel's good at processing his emotions in such a way where he doesn't really necessarily express them or allow them to affect his demeanor. So if he's going to walk out, for example, and there's going to be like media cameras there filming him, I'm sure he'll walk out as a real cool cat that doesn't really feel much at all. But I miss the guy so much, you know. I'm just really looking forward to seeing him. But in relation to what you said about how hard the authorities go on people who come from nationalism, nationalist activism, I think what happens, I really think it comes down to human naivety. I think what happens, I wish I could be a fly on the wall actually in a meeting like this. I think certain police units that are quite green to this kind of politics and this kind of activism, that is to say, they are taken from other fields where they've been stationed for a while, so they don't really know much about characters such as you and me. They haven't been exposed to this stuff before. They're put into a room, these coppers, and some political bureaucrat, some police bureaucrat stands there and explains that these guys are terrorists. Basically, they're a terror threat. They're extremely dangerous. They have knowledge of all sorts of dangerous stuff, weapons, etc. They're known to be violent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they basically brainwash these naive cops that don't really know much about us. And the cops go in really hard thinking that they're doing something great for the community when really they're being set upon, focused on pretty much the last semblance of resistance against the end of society. That's kind of how I see what we're doing sometimes. You know, the fall of our civilization, we're trying to resist that. But I think that's what happens. It's just naivety, and it'll continue because, speaking of prison, they do the same thing in prison, Mark. They shuffle around the prison guards so that you don't get the same guards in your unit for any longer than about a month. They put new ones in that you haven't seen before, and then they stay for about a month, maybe 6 weeks. They move them on. Then new guards come through, maybe from another prison, because the prisons are typically run by either the government or private security companies that have a great deal of personnel working across the entire country, right? So you often don't spend a lot of time with the same prison officers when you're in jail, just as you probably won't deal with the same police officers very frequently in Australian activism, nationalist activism. And the reason that revolving door of personnel exists is to keep everyone naive as to the reality of like what these people are actually doing, and to prevent anyone from developing sympathies or friends. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah, I can imagine that it makes it harder as well. So when you're in jail, I've never been in jail, but I can imagine when you're in jail, things like familiar faces, people that you're used to, make it feel slightly easier. And Sam did say this to me. He said when he was inside, knowing the lads on the wing, knowing the guys that you did your job with. So one of Sam's jobs was the cafeteria, in the cafeteria. Now, interestingly, he said that basically the pedos made the food. The pedos cooked the food, so they were out of the way. Then they would send it up, and then him and his team would serve it in the servery to everyone. and then they would clean up afterwards. And one of the great things about being on the servery was not only were you out of your cell, but you're out of your cell for a long time and working with the same group of lads. And after a while, it felt a little bit like it was your group of friends. You know, you knew everyone, you got on with them, there was a bit of banter. But he said by moving people around, it took that away from them. And it's almost like a reset. So if you're getting on really well with everyone in one prison and they move you to another prison, you are starting from scratch again. Everyone's got to get to know you. Everyone's like, what are you in for, mate? And you have to have this, you have this sort of big reset. And obviously all of this is designed to persecute some more than others. Because if they want to make your life slightly easier, they keep you around the same people, they keep you on the same tasks, they allow you to build friendships. If they don't want you to have any of those things, they keep moving you, they keep you on lockdown, they keep moving you from wing to wing, stop letting you have a consistent job. And that's all part of the punishment. And then the punishment starts to stray into the territory, almost of torture, because some of these guys aren't allowed to speak to friends and family. And we've had the same thing in the UK where we've been speaking to political prisoners. And then all of a sudden the guy stops calling and you get word from someone else that he's still allowed to call, that he's not allowed to call you anymore because the state have just updated their lists of people he isn't allowed to speak to. It's all very, very unfair. But one other thing I wanted to ask you is what's happening with, obviously the NSN was forced to close down. What's happening with that law? Has that law been formally brought in yet? Or is it still sort of in the process of coming in? And obviously I'm going to get Tom Sewell on again at some point to give us an update on the legal case. But since all of that, what's the feeling from normal Aussies there about freedom of speech? Because to us in the UK, when we were watching this from the outside looking in, it just seemed this huge blow for freedom and huge blow for any nationalist group that even wanted to start a political party.
It's a good question, actually. I'm not really sure what's happening with that law. I'm also not sure what's happening with the process of challenging that law, but from what I understand, there is currently some sort of move to try to get the High Court, and this was my understanding of what Tom Sewell is currently doing. He's dealing with lawyers behind the scenes. He's trying to get the High Court in Australia to make an injunction that let me start from scratch in case people don't understand what's happened. After the Bondi terror attack in Australia that I mentioned earlier, where people were shot on Bondi Beach, it's like a major beach in New South Wales, Australia. It was the worst terror attack in our country's history. Off the back of that terror attack, the government introduced a new threshold of crime they're calling hate crime. It doesn't have to be violent crime. Basically, hate crime can be something you're saying on the internet. It can be an ideology that you're subscribing to. And certain groups with an ideological or religious basis that the government feels is threatening, they can be outlawed as hate groups. Basically, it's a whole new category of crime, and it's a whole new way for the government in Australia to list certain groups as terror groups without them actually doing anything related to violence or terrorism. It's a pretty egregious law. In the actual legislation, it says things like, no criminal convictions required, no procedural fairness required. Basically, there'll be a bureaucratic process within government, amongst certain government officials, that decides who's allowed to exist as a political protest group or a political party and who's not, on the basis of their ideology and perhaps even their personal character. It basically cancels democracy, Mark, put it that way. We have new hate crime legislation in Australia which cancels democracy. And it's being celebrated by the government as a fantastic thing. So far, though, interestingly, they haven't used it to list the National Socialist Network or Tom Sewell's White Australia as a hate group. However, while the legislation was being passed, and you kind of know stuff like this is going to pass, even though it shouldn't pass in any fair democratic country, you know it's going to pass when they introduce it. You just like when you hear the sort of people that are trying to get it through, the prime minister supports it, the opposition kind of supports it too. You're like, okay, this is going to pass. Jesus. So while it was passing, Tom Sewell disbanded the National Socialist Network and White Australia completely. I think the White Australia Party, the logistics required to register that party still exists, but the registration hasn't been completed because the Australian Electoral Commission basically hasn't responded to them. They're not really sure whether they can register them on the basis of these new laws. That's my understanding. I could be wrong. I could be getting my facts wrong with the AEC. I'm not sure if a registration is being put forward to the AEC. It was my understanding that it had been done, but I'm not exactly sure at this stage. But what I will say is what's happening now, my understanding of what's happening now is that in order for the White Australia Party to be registered, so people like Thomas Sewell and Joel Davis and Jacob Hursen and Jack Eltis can contest elections in the future, and you know various other candidates can pop up as Senate candidates or regional candidates. You know, everyone who's anyone in Australia in right-wing activism is considering being involved or was considering being involved with this White Australia Party, which I believe is what prompted the government to introduce this hate crime law and rush it through off the back of a terror attack. Because right now there is a giant space for a far right presence to really pick up a lot of votes in Australia. There's a very dissatisfied white Australian working class down here. They just don't have anyone to vote for. There's One Nation, but it's just not far right enough. People need something a little bit more hardline. And they're looking for something to vote, someone to vote for. And the White Australia Party, although it might sound a little crass to people who don't understand the history of Australia, the policy upon which Australia was founded was called the White Australia Policy. So it has roots in Australian history, this stuff. It's very clever what the boys were doing. But the government introduced this hate crime legislation. And in order to prevent him, all of his boys from going to jail overnight, Tom Sewell publicly disbanded the group. But what he's doing is trying to get the High Court, he's working with some lawyers to try to get the High Court to make a special injunction that hate crime legislation cannot apply to a political party. And I think it's a reasonable injunction for the High Court to make. I think in order to preserve any semblance of democracy, they would need to make that injunction because political parties being denied registration or banned and outlawed on the basis of their ideology, without having committed a crime, without having encouraged violence, and without any procedural fairness or any route of appeal, like that's not even a democracy. It has no relation to democracy. So that's my understanding of what's going on. I'm not sure where that's at. I do talk to Tom pretty regularly. He's a close friend of mine, but he's been pretty busy for the last few weeks, and I suppose I'll drop him a line. And he'll give everybody an update as to what's going on with that. The ideal result, Mark, the ideal result is that the High Court does accept or make an injunction. The High Court does rule that this hate crime legislation cannot be used to ban or, you know, wipe out political parties, can't apply to political parties. The boys register White Australia, and then all the remaining traditional working Australians have someone to vote for. They have a banner to rally behind. I think that's what the current government is terrified of. And I think that's why they've done what they've done with the hate crime legislation, with the police pressure, with the stacks of criminal charges. They've pretty much slapped on every single member or leading member of White Australia. I think this is all and I don't usually get into, you know, I'm pretty fair. I don't usually weigh in too much on the conspiratorial stuff. But when you look at all the evidence, there's a strong effort by the existing government, the existing political parties, to gatekeep their community, to gatekeep their class, the political class. They don't want to allow White Australia a seat at the table because I think they know White Australia could run away with a victory and pretty much seize control of the country if they're not careful. So a lot is being done to prevent that at a government level.
Well, I'm not sure whether a party like White Australia would sort of you know, storm it at the ballot box. It's very difficult to do that. And I've thought that many times myself. You know, when I was in the BNP, I was expecting us to to walk away with it. And there was always a softer option presented at exactly the same time. And that softer option was always the thing that the public, you know, decided to vote for instead of voting for us. But I think what they fear with groups like White Australia is once you are a political party, once you're on the ballot paper, it gives you a degree of over an ear of respectability where you can say, look, we are the real deal. We are officially registered. And at that point, you have protections. And I believe that that's what they were scared of in your case, because if you had the protections to keep doing what you were doing and you were officially registered, I think it would have been very hard at that point for them to do the things they were doing to
The NSN. You are right. You have to understand that. I had the same opinion. I thought, even if these guys get registered, I don't think they'll get a lot of votes. I was thinking it's going to take them a long time to cement themselves into, you know, official political political culture, because people tend to vote either one way or the other with the, this is kind of like a two-party system that we have in Australia, just like in most countries, and they're very traditional about that. But the boomers are traditional about that. And there's this whole new generation, you know, even us, we will vote more radically than the boomers. We don't want to vote for any major party. You know, we're in our 30s and 40s. So pretty much anyone that age and below is going to vote for something more radical and is really fed up with what's going on in the country. And when I saw August 31st last year, the first ever March for Australia rally, which was a huge phenomenon, and Tom Sewell and the NSN, how should I explain? They acted as sort of a makeshift security that allowed that rally to go ahead. When I saw how regular people reacted to literal Nazis walking into this rally to participate in it, to protect it, and to play a leading role in it, I was shocked. I was actually shocked. I didn't expect to see that. And when people were, well, the way they reacted is they supported them wholeheartedly. They cheered them. They shook their hands. They wanted to get in photos with them. And when I saw interviews later of regular people being asked about Tom Sewell and the guys, like, what do you think about these guys? Like, isn't it a problem that there's Nazis at your rally? The people shrugged. The people shrugged and said, well, they're against immigration. That's what the rally's about, so I don't care. And someone would say, really? You don't? Some journalist was trying to bait them, saying, you don't care that there's a Nazi up there speaking right now? And they're like, nah. I was like, wow, that's how fed up people are. People are so fed up that they would vote for a white, I think they would vote for a white nationalist party in Australia. I think that's the way, you have to understand the Australian demeanor, the Australian character. We won't always fight aggressively and in the moment, but I think sticking it to them, you know, rejecting official bureaucracy in a way that's like profound, sudden, unexpected. You know, we're a rebellious spirit down here. And that's why I think the White Australia Party would actually get a fair few. Well, you got to understand, One Nation down here was a party that was a bit of a phenomenon. It kind of broke into the scene of official politics very suddenly. And Pauline Hanson was the leader of that party, still is. And she had a lot of problems back in the day. She even was put in jail for a while for some tax reason or something, but it was all political, whatever. But I feel that that phenomenon could have been repeating with White Australia, which is why in this case, the existing government, the existing political class, they were thinking, hey, we've seen this before. Hey, we're kind of more schooled in this process than we were the first time. So let's not let it happen again. But yeah, I'm just hoping the High Court makes that ruling so they can participate in official politics.
I have a slightly sort of more grim view of things than you, obviously, but it might be different in Australia, and I hope it is. Here in the UK, when push comes to shove, people always take the the softer option. So people in this country are so scared of being called racist. But anyway, one of the big things I wanted to talk to you about, and you've been talking about this a little bit on your own sort of Telegram page, is the situation that's unfolding with petrol prices, with food prices, with really the fallout from what's going on in Iran. Now, I'm not sure what your take is on this, but since my sort of earliest days in nationalism, the old hands in the nationalist movement, the people that I was meeting and talking with that had been doing, so when I came into things in about the year 2000, you know, the 1970s weren't that long ago. I was only sort of in my early 20s. And there was people who had been in the National Front, you know, in their 20s or in their 30s. And now they're in the BNP. And they were in their sort of, you know, 40s or 50s. A lot of life left in them, very eager. And they would always sort of cool us down when the younger ones were saying, you know, this is our time. We're going to do this. We're going to smash it. And they would always say, look, it's not going to be that easy. If we're going to win, the first thing that we need is a situation whereby there is genuine economic hardship. You know, these guys had seen, you know, years of election campaigns. They'd seen sort of decades of nationalists building up through big marches and then getting nowhere and then at the ballot box getting a derisory vote. And one of the things that I was always told was, until we get this big economic collapse, until there's a depression, until people can't afford to turn the heating on and don't know if they can feed their family anymore, people aren't going to be dislodged. People aren't going to decide to vote for an outsider group. And here we are, and we are starting to see genuine hardship. You know, I was traveling past a forecourt the other day, which is usually the cheapest in our area. It's over £1.50 a litre for petrol and nearly £1.90 a litre for diesel, which is, you know, record price levels. People won't be able to afford that. Is this what people need for the final push over the edge? Or do you just think this is going to be another big blip where, oh, well, you know, 2-3 years down the line, well, remember when it was really bad and Trump took people into Iran and the petrol almost ran out, but here we are and we've forgotten about it and we've moved on and we've got on with life? Or do you think we are moving to a time where there is going to be genuine hardship? Or maybe this is going to be something that our government sees upon to get rid of petrol cars, to ration petrol, to bring in more controls on our lives like they did through COVID. How do you think this is going to play out?
It's only one piece of the puzzle. You have to be ready for a crisis like this. You have to be prepared. You have to have the right kind of manpower and political force to capitalize on it if you are going to use it to your advantage, or if you're going to use any sort of crisis to your advantage. And that's why it's curious that such a strong effort, it's curious to me, that so much has been done to shut down and, you know, White Australia Party, shut down and criminalize them right before this crisis has panned out. Maybe that's connected, maybe not. But I know that if the White Australia Party did get registered, let's say late last year when they intended to, before the hate crime legislation was rushed through Parliament, they'd be in a very strong position right now to deconstruct or delegitimize the existing government and assure people that they could put their faith into them rather than the existing Labor government in Australia. But rather, the situation we have instead is that that group has been forced to disband by emergency law changes off the back of a terror attack. This crisis has come into being, and Albanese is just ruling Australia with an iron fist. His main political opposition, the Liberal Party, is just in absolute tatters. They can't even figure out who's going to lead which state. And so it's going to be a Labor government in Australia for a while. They're going to be able to do whatever it is they please, which is another reason Joel's just being thrown in jail without really any fair due process, like they pretend that there is, but there's not. But look, the petrol prices, the diesel prices are similar in Australia when you compare the differences in currency. For us, we're looking at about $2.50 a litre for petrol, and that's shitty 91 petrol, which they don't even have. When I went to England 18 months ago and caught up with you, Mark, I noticed they don't even sell 91 through most of England. It's 95 minimum, I'm pretty sure. And so 91 is a rat shit grade of fuel that most of Europe doesn't even sell. And in Australia, that's $2.50 a litre just for that. Plus, the government has made some ruling here that the sulfur content of fuel can now be higher in order to stretch it out more. So it's even worse than 91, probably. It's really probably bad for your car, but they don't care. They just want to keep everything ticking over as long as they can. Diesel is the real problem. Australia is a huge consumer of diesel. And as a result of diesel being understood as more efficient, which I think it is, it burns a little slower and pound for pound, it gets you a little further. A lot of diesel engines have been sold to people, diesel cars, just regular SUVs for families. But anyone who thought they were being smart by buying a diesel engine is now really suffering because the price of diesel just recently approached $3.50 per litre, which works out to be about the same as the fuel prices in England, as I said. But look, the government's come in recently and said, hey, we're gonna cut the fuel tax in half to ease the pressure for you guys. So, you know, 50% less tax on fuel for everybody. But the funny thing is it took about a week for that price reduction to come into being, to be implemented by the fuel stations. And by the time a week rolled around, the price had actually increased so much, all the fuel tax cut achieved was actually leveling out prices for a few days. It didn't really reduce prices very much, maybe by about 15 cents in some regions, but it didn't really have that much of an impact. But this war, I suppose we've got a lot to say about this war, Mark. What do you think about this war? Did you foresee something like this? Is this the time it was supposed to happen? What are you thinking?
Well, I've been posting a few mashups on my Telegram of Trump saying, you know, he's going to be the president of peace. He's going to be the guy that stops the wars. He's going to be the guy that stops American military interventions. This is going to be a new era. It's America first. But he has become slavishly pro-Israel to the point where he would do anything they said. Now, with Trump, it's always hard to kind of see where he's going to go. So when he went into North Korea, what happened? Well, he came out of North Korea, you know, singing the praises of the North Korean leader, the North Korean establishment, and basically being best buddies with them. You know, and that was the end of North Korea as the bad guy. And Trump is very, very unpredictable in how he behaves. You're not quite sure what you're going to get with him. And it's little things that can throw him off. But with Iran, he seems to have been absolutely doggedly pro-war. But that's part of a wider shift. And all of a sudden, you know, it started around Venezuela. Then he started threatening Colombia, Cuba, Greenland. Now it's Iran. It almost seems like he's on a little bit of a rampage. And some of this, I'm not saying that the guy's a good guy or anything like this, but he's obviously being led round by the nose by Israel. They have got him into this to a large degree. And, you know, even the mainstream media have said that originally Israel was saying, look, this is only going to be a week of bombing. We just need your help for maybe 3 or 4 days, you know, 8 days tops. And here they are, like a month later, and the world economy is grinding to a halt. America has been largely humiliated. There are now dead Americans, and Trump can't see his way out other than by sending ground troops in. And some of this is obviously Israel, but I've spoken about this on other shows and said some of this is actually a result of how isolated Trump is. So when you look at Trump now, he's not in the White House. He's not in the Pentagon. He's at Mar-a-Lago, surrounded by fewer and fewer people. The people he was close with, the people that did surround him in the White House, they're not there anymore. The people who are surrounding him are increasingly of Jewish descent, very war hawkish. They're the ones he's listening to. And he's even cut off on social media. So rather than making proper social media posts on X, he posts on Truth Social so he can immediately ban anybody who says something that he doesn't agree with. And isolation of that kind is usually very, very bad for people. Now, I don't want to go down the line of being like, well, the Democrats were so professional because when they did war, they did it from the White House or the Pentagon. But there is something about doing war from the White House or the Pentagon. And one of the things that shows that Trump is in this state of mental flux, and I spoke about this earlier in the week on Patrick Slattery's show, is if you remember when we went to war with Iraq, the lies were quite consistent for a long period. Weapons of mass destruction, 45 minutes to deploy the missiles. We've got to get Saddam Hussein in a box before he puts us in a box. You know, where's he going to strike next? That was consistent. It was a lie, but it was a consistent lie. Now, what we've heard around this war, it changes on a daily basis. Regime change, energy stability, getting rid of the Ayatollah, supporting people in Iran who are protesting, stopping Israel from being wiped off the face of the map, stopping the nuclear weapons. Well, they weren't going to have a nuclear weapon, but maybe they were going to have one. They were developing one, but they've been developing one for 50 years. Oh, well, we have to get rid of the Ayatollah. Well, you've already said that, but then you said that wasn't the reason. And you're looking at Trump, and it's almost schizophrenic. And you can see that in 4 weeks of Iran, there has been less consistency, more chaos, more lies, more uncertainty, and more humiliations for Trump than there was really for Bush and the Americans in the whole of the Iraq war. Now, I know more American soldiers died in the Iraq war, but, you know, Bush didn't claim he was negotiating with the Iraqi leaders only for them to release a press statement saying, we've not even spoken to this guy, he's a clown, he's making it up. I mean, the world's looking at him and thinking, what are you doing? You know, mainstream newspapers are producing memes or cartoons where Trump's talking to himself in the mirror, saying, these negotiations are going very well indeed. You know, he looks like a madman. He's isolated, cut off. You know, there's reports that he's had some arguments with Israel, which is insane because, you know, he basically works for them. And it's quite hard to understand where he'll go next. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if I woke up in the morning and Trump had said, it's over. We've proved everything we've needed to prove. We're backing away. They've agreed to no more nuclear missiles. I'm the president of peace because I've got rid of nukes in the Middle East. I wouldn't be surprised if he did that. If I woke up in the morning and 40,000 Marines were headed to Iran for a full-on ground invasion, I wouldn't be surprised about that either, because it's just total chaos. And the people he's surrounding himself with are the worst of the worst. Pete Hegseth, he's not a professional. You know, I think he was a Fox News analyst. You know, they're people who are sycophants. And employing sycophants, it might make you feel good, but they're not the right people. You know, if you say, well, who are you going to employ as your doctor? This guy who doesn't really agree with you on a lot of things, but is a trained medical professional. Or your best mate who watched a couple of episodes of, you know, Casualty once. And, you know, he's like, well, I'm your best mate. You know, I have watched a few TV documentaries on surgery. So employ me. You're not going to employ your best mate just because he's your best mate. But Trump, unfortunately, has employed all of his, like, low IQ mates who can't actually do the job, and it's not really working out for him, is it?
A friend of mine uses a term, quantum politics. Basically, it means that in modern politics, it's like everything is happening and not happening at the same time. Trump is invading Iran, he's not. He is at war with Iran, but he's also not. He's going to keep bombing Iran, he's not. The straits open, the straits closed. It's like, which do you want to believe? And the internet is just so overloaded with opposing viewpoints that are representing opposite realities that whatever you want to believe is there for you to believe if you choose to. And I don't know if that's a good or bad thing for average people. It's probably not a good thing. Probably better for everyone to be kept on the same page by a more centralized source of information. But usually when that happens, the centralized source of information is controlled by the wrong people. So, look, I agree with you. I agree with you. I've been reading too much and watching too much about this conflict between America and Iran, Israel, America and Iran, or just the Middle East, however you want to describe this. I've been reading and studying it so much, reading about and studying it so much that it seems to have almost affected my outlook on life generally. I've become much more cynical and negative. And I noticed this in myself a few days ago because I was starting to think, what's even the point of going to work today? And I realized it's because my mind is so fixated on these broader worldly matters, this foreign conflict, which isn't necessarily consequential to me right now. And so I pulled myself up, and for the last couple of days, I haven't been looking into it as much because I'm learning so much as this conflict unfolds. It's like every 30 minutes, there's something new happening that I didn't understand. I initially don't understand, and then I begin to understand it. And there's so much I can say about it. I'll do my best to be concise, give you my opinions. Trump seems to be embarrassed. He's visibly embarrassed and frustrated. Okay. When he says that Iran is begging to make a deal, clearly that's not the truth. Maybe people are telling him that, and maybe he's believing it. Maybe they're saying it to make him feel better. But look, hats off to the guy for basically taking over America and just doing whatever he wants, going into other countries, bombing schools, stealing leaders, kidnapping leaders, and, you know, starting wars that he just writes off as military operations. They're not actually wars for legal reasons. The guy's basically taken over America and is now the commander in chief of what is understood to be the most powerful military in the world. And I'm sure various statesmen and politicians in recent history have dreamed of doing that with America, but never quite got there. They had to go through the proper processes, the Congress and whatever else goes on with the bureaucratic procedures there. But Trump, to use a Churchill expression, seems to have gripped America by the hair on its head and is doing whatever he wants with its forces. Look, some people are saying, they're going as far as suggesting that it's just a proxy war and an excuse to cause economic chaos, to bring about 15-minute cities, get rid of meat, get rid of petrol cars, Agenda 2030, that kind of stuff. And that very much could be the case. But for us mortals down here on the bottom plane, where we unfortunately have to reside, all we can do is speculate about stuff like that. However, based on the way things have panned out and based on what I'm hearing, what I'm seeing from all the different sources of information I'm getting on the war, I do feel it will escalate quite sharply over the Easter weekend. That's this weekend. Basically, if Trump is going to send in ground forces to secure oil infrastructure, which it looks like he might want to do, however, he's making it seem like he doesn't need to do that. He's making it seem like America has plenty of oil. I don't even care about the Strait of Hormuz. He's saying, if Australia, Europe, England, if you guys want oil, go to the Strait of Hormuz and open it yourself. It's almost like a dismissive, passive-aggressive statement too, because he feels let down by the lack of support from Europe, from England and Australia as well. I think he expected them to send some warboats and there was going to be some coalition. You know, the cool guys are going to come in together. The boys are going to come in together and reopen the strait forcibly and then go into Iran and conquer it together. I think Trump felt like that he could, with one word and no real process, just summon all the forces of the world to his bidding. And because that didn't happen, he's now saying, well, screw you guys. You know, like, I don't even care about you. If you guys want something, you guys take it for yourself. I'm not babysitting you anymore. So that and other things seem to be demonstrating to me that the world is receding, reverting back into a place that's more, it consists more of exclusive empires that are a little more independent and self-sufficient, that the world of the future won't be so interconnected and countries around the world won't be so dependent on very volatile and unreliable sources, routes of resource. Australia, for example, Australia doesn't actually logistically need the Strait of Hormuz. It does because it hasn't got the infrastructure to pump its own oil out of the ground. But we have up to 50 years of oil to refine and provide to keep our country going at its current consumption rate for about 50 years. And I'm sure we could find ways to stretch that out to make it even longer. But because of globalism and politicians that are just generally unscrupulous, they cave to foreign market planning and manipulation. They're easily bought off, easily led into traps. Politicians over the last few decades in Australia have literally shut down all of Australia's oil refineries, have built no infrastructure to pump our own oil out of the ground, and are just buying everything from overseas. But we don't even have 30 days worth of oil worth of diesel or petrol stored in this country. So we rely on places or routes of resource routes like the Strait of Hormuz. We rely on that not because we actually need it, because we do have what we need here in this country, but just because of weak and unscrupulous leadership, just corrupt leadership that sells out to the international market and leaves the country completely open to foreign market manipulation. That's why, like, Albanese doesn't want to say it, the Australian government officials don't want to say it, but the reason petrol prices, diesel prices are so high, yes, it's downstream from the war in Iran, but the real reason is because the political class in Australia has left Australia open to this manipulation, these volatile regions in the world, because they've refused to make our country self-sufficient. They've plugged us into the global matrix, even though it was a very unreliable and bad decision. They plugged us into this globalist system, and now Australia is suffering the consequences when we never needed to be plugged in the first place, which is the frustrating thing. But look, you know what the truth is, Mark? The truth is if Trump is going to send ground forces into Iran, he's going to have to bomb the shit out of it beforehand. He's going to have to decimate the Iranian forces to make it more accessible to American troops, because otherwise American troops are going to get smashed. I mean, they'll eventually win, but they'll incur heavy losses. And there's been talk about dropping a nuke on Iran, and I wouldn't be surprised if they did it. I wouldn't be surprised. Israel would do it in a heartbeat. Think of it this way, Mark. Trump's war room, I guarantee you this has happened. Trump's war room, 1 a.m. one night, someone said, you know, we could just nuke him. And then there was some low chuckles around the table. And then the guy who made the comment in the first place, he leaned back, and as the laughter died down, they all exchanged some looks. And he goes, I'm serious, we could. And then the response would have been, what shape are our nuclear facilities in? Have we tested a nuclear bomb in the last few years? Do they even work? Can someone look into this? So that's what's happening right now in America. Or that probably happened 3 weeks ago. You know, so, and Israel will nuke the shit out of Iran in a heartbeat. They don't care. They don't care about anyone who's not Jewish. They'll nuke the shit out of Iran. It's just, and America has dropped an atomic bomb called Little Boy on Japan after Japan refused to surrender at the end of World War II. So there's no humanitarian barrier for them doing this. If it means a faster end to the war and getting rid of Iran as an opponent in the region, then, you know, they'd be considering it. They'd be seriously considering it. And I think there's been open talk about it too, coming out of Israel, maybe. But I'm just trying to focus on what it means for us down here in Australia, as I'm sure you're trying to think about what it means for England. And my gut feeling, because I've carried on about this for some time now, my gut feeling is that what this means is there is going to be a reshaping of the world to some extent. This is going to change our lives permanently. It's going to change the way things roll out. We just had an address to the nation, as I think you guys did too, from Keir Starmer. We had an address to the nation from Anthony Albanese. And Donald Trump also gave an address to the nation regarding the price of fuel and the effect that the war is having on the global economy. But what's curious is this address to the nation, I don't know what yours was like, but it was kind of a nothing burger. There was not really much in it. It was just everyone needs to do their part, lines like that. You know, use less fuel, drive less if you can, and everyone needs to do their part to get us through this difficult time. So really it was just, there was no point in anything that Albanese said in this address to the nation. But the last time there was an address to the nation by England, Australia, and America simultaneously at the same time, that was just prior to the COVID dilemma and the lockdowns. And, you know, a lot of people think that we could run dry of fuel to the extent where people are confined to certain regions. Driving a petrol car will be viewed as something abhorrent that you shouldn't be doing because it's too costly and it's bad for the environment. Obviously, there's elitists in the world who aren't going to waste this opportunity to impose a sort of regime like that. There are people in the world who want people to live in a regime like that. And this looks like it could be a very good opportunity to impose something like that. So we'll see what happens, but I'm just curious to see what's going to happen over this weekend, this Easter weekend. I feel like it will be, I don't know, I don't want to say decisive. I don't know if there's anything that can bring about a fast end to the war. Trump doesn't want to be embarrassed. He's looking for the least embarrassing exit from the situation, but there's no way to get out of it without sort of either acknowledging some level of defeat or dropping a nuke and just decimating the shit out of them. So then he can finally say, hey, I told you I won. They said they wanted to do a deal, but then they wouldn't agree. So we took them out. Fuck them. You know, something like that. That's if he's going to be driven by ego, he could do something like that. And I'm sure Israel would back it. But I, you know, it's a terrible thing when something like this happens. I suppose I'm getting a bit softer as I get older. And I think about children getting killed. I think about this school that's been blown up, the girls' school. And you think more about that stuff, especially when, you know, you've got people in the family having children. You, Mark, have your own children. You get a little bit softer on the humanitarian side of things, despite us being depicted by mainstream media as gruesome fascists. You know, it leaves you with a bad feeling when you see the kind of devastation that war like this causes for people that aren't even involved and don't want to be involved, for people who are just trying to live their lives. And that's, you know, I suppose that's always just a consideration in war, or it's a consideration for some people. For some people, they don't consider it at all. But how do you think it's going to go? What do you think the point is?
As I said earlier, there's so much chaos around this. It's difficult to ascertain. So, you know, the other day, Trump was saying, well, we're in this to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Well, the Strait of Hormuz was open until you started this. You know, it was your meddling interventionism, nonsense, naked aggression that closed the Strait of Hormuz. It wasn't Iran, it was America's actions that led to the Strait of Hormuz being closed. But now one of the reasons we're doing this is for energy stability. Well, we had energy stability until this began, until America started off down this route. And as I said, with Trump, I think there was something on the Daily Mail site earlier. Trump had made another, I'll see if it's still there, but Trump had, you know, Trump's all over the place. So this is one of the things. Trump reveals he'll torch NATO in landmark speech tonight as he absolutely threatens to quit disgusting alliance. So, you know, here's Trump spurging out because no one wants to be involved in the conflict. You know, that's pretty telling about the mental state he's in, that he's not calling meetings. He isn't, you know, getting people together and saying, right, let's get all the heads of NATO around to discuss this, discuss what we should do. He's just saying, right, I'm going to make a speech and tell everyone they're absolute arses in front of the world's media, because that's going to make things better. I think there was something earlier today, and I'm looking for it in the news feed, but I can't find it. And it was about Trump saying,
he seems to be doubting that much of Europe even has the military might or the will to help anyone in any war. And the problem with a lot of Europe, especially Western Europe, England has the same problem as Australia, is they're so locked down in a demographic crisis with mass immigration, just basically tearing the countries apart, tearing England apart, tearing Australia, dividing Australia, that neither country is in a position to support anyone's war. I wrote about that in a Telegram post recently. Like, we have such a large Muslim population that's influential. If Australia openly supported a war against a Muslim country, you've got like war on the streets in some suburbs here that are heavily Muslim populated. You've got a massively increased threshold of terrorism and possibility of terrorism suddenly. So getting into any foreign war for England or Australia means chaos for us in our streets, in our homes. And I think like that's what kind of prevents these, it's what prevented Australia from supporting Trump's war more directly.
Well, another headline that was up today, Trump says Iran's new leader has asked for a ceasefire and he's considering it if Hormuz is opened. Britain to host 35 nation talks on reopening the Strait of Hormuz and getting oil and gas flowing again to lower prices after Trump's get your own outburst. It's complete chaos. And this is what I mean about the Iraq war. The Iraq war wasn't a good thing. It wasn't a just thing. It was a terrible thing. But despite all of those assessments, it was at least something that seemed orderly. And the countries that participated had clear goals, and they did things in a way that seemed militarily expedient. And anything could happen next. But, I mean, look, it's like these 15-minute cities, okay? Now, people are going to crucify me for saying this, but Britain was full of 15-minute cities at one point. Britain was a country where people would bike or walk to the shops in their village because working class people didn't have motor cars, really, in vast numbers until the 1980s. Both of my grandparents, both sets of my grandparents, never even learned to drive. They walked to the shops, they biked to the shops, they got their groceries from the local greengrocers, the butchers, the bakers. It's quite recent that every family had two motor cars. That's something that's a post-1980s change. Now, if you said to me, we were going back to a homogenous white nation where people, rather than using motor cars and going to the supermarket, walk down to the village greengrocers to get their vegetables, went to the butchers, went to the bakers to get their goods every week, I'd be far happier with that than I am now with families piling into the car, driving 25 minutes to buy all of their food from a giant solar supermarket that has its foot on the neck of every farmer and supplier, driving down their quality of life and making this country a worse place. It's a complex thing. And to me, I see sort of threats and opportunities here. Now, obviously, 15-minute cities are a dirty word. It's a dirty concept now because everyone's used to cars. But was Britain a better place when motor car ownership was less common and people used local services and amenities? Or is it better now when we've got rid of the trains, the bus services, you know, all the local shops, and you just travel to out-of-town retail parks to buy your shopping? And even they're closing down now because Amazon does it all. You know, if you want community back, you have to deal with community. You have to deal with your local butchers, your bakers. You have to go to the local shops. You have to know everyone in your village. You know, one of the things that atomized us was this idea that we'd all sit in our own little cars and drive 30 minutes to get our food. You know, that wasn't how this country ever was until very recently. So I'm not against people building local communities again. As for the war and whether that will do that, I doubt it. I should imagine that if I was a betting man, I always bet on nothing really ever happening and things returning to normal. And if people say, well, why do I bet on that? I bet on that because I lived through COVID and I saw people locked down in their houses. Do you know what? This is weird, but there was a woman in my city centre the other week, probably the first I've seen in a while, still wearing a COVID mask. So there are people still walking around in COVID masks. But one of the things I've got to say is, the strange thing is, a lot of people thought things would never go back to normal after COVID. There were a lot of content creators saying, when COVID hits, this is different. This is the game changer. But everything went back to normal. So somehow, I always just foresee things going back to normal and are still just engaging in this slow decline towards minority status and basically the end of our people. That's just how it's been and how I foresee it. So, you know, that's if I was a betting man. Now, as I said, I could wake up tomorrow morning and Trump's nuked Tehran. And you're looking at it, you're thinking, oh, my God. Why did he do that? But he could also wake up tomorrow morning and he's pulled everyone out and gone off in a huff saying, I'm not helping anyone again. And I'm starting my own version of NATO because I'm a big fat baby. You know, he is sort of so chaotic and wild. You honestly don't know what he's going to do. And now he's embroiled in problems at home too, because it looks as if his anti-birthright citizenship presidential decree is going to fall as well at the Supreme Court. So he's sort of embroiled in failure every which way. And if he's seen to be the president of failure, his own party will turn on him, because he's only got one sort of term as president left. He's only got until the end of this term, and then he's done anyway, because you can't be a president for three terms. But here's the issue, Blair. There's lots of politicians surrounding him that are banking on being a congressman or a senator for many more terms. And if they're eternally tied to Trump, if he goes down like the Hindenburg, they go down with him. And I think what might restrain him is the fact that these midterms are coming up in November, and that's closer than you think. And there are many people within the Republicans who are getting very, very worried about their prospects of re-election and potentially a disastrous midterm election ending up leading to a second impeachment.
Did things go back to normal after COVID? Do you really feel like they went back to normal the way they were before?
Yeah, people forgot about it. People got on with life. No one cares. You know,
ostensibly, but to me it feels like post-COVID society is like a pretend world that only resembles reality, a pretend world preceding some sort of vicious change. That's what it feels like. Everyone's retarded, Mark, and everyone hates each other now. That's what COVID achieved. There's so many people out there not working now with medical issues, on a disability pension. You go down to the shopping center in the middle of the week at like 11 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon when everyone would typically be at work, and there are so many people there. There are so many cars, you can't even get a car park. And everyone is fat and bitter. Everyone is fat and bitter. And I just think to myself every time I go out in public, this can't go on much longer. Where's this going? A colony which feeds its sick and its weak and puts the worst of itself first, where's that going? It's going into the ground, and it's going into the ground within a generation or two. So I'm looking at this whole post-COVID system and just how sick and embittered everybody is. And in my heart, in my gut, I feel that it's about to have a big full stop put on it. I don't know how that's going to happen, but...
But don't you worry, Blair, don't you worry, because what you're saying, I can't argue with anything you've said, okay? But don't you worry that all these fat, useless, embittered, permanently sickly people who live off the state are all essentially in some kind of chains. I think I know you pretty well. You're an intelligent guy, but you're resilient, and you're the kind of guy that wouldn't like to live off anybody else. And if somebody said to you, you can live in a gilded cage, or you can be free and go and build a shack over by that watering hole and essentially live a harder life, but have total freedom over what you do, what you say, the way you think, or you can live in this gilded cage and you can have lots of nice things and free money and computer games and TV, but you have to say the right thing and, you know, come out of your house and clap every night for the COVID special workers, I bet you'd go and live by the watering hole, build a shack and live free. But most people wouldn't.
I might initially think, well, the nice things sound pretty good. I might try that out, but then it wouldn't last very long. Like within 48 hours, I've already committed a hate crime and done some hate speech without even meaning it. And now I'm forced to go out to the shack, and I've probably got the coppers chasing me on my way there. But yeah, I don't know. What I'm trying to say is I'd be very surprised if some society reshaping didn't come about as a result of this Iran situation. I'd be very surprised, because it's a huge opportunity, Mark. It's even if it hasn't been planned around this specific incident, even if this is Trump being wild, I think down like the Strait of Hormuz being shut effectively is huge. It's a huge excuse to suddenly shake up the economy and change the way things work. It's a huge opportunity, and I'd be surprised if elitists wasted it. I mean, at the very least, it's going to be used to make a lot of money, and that's already happening for some people in the right places.
It is. Yeah, and that's how it's going to be. But I worry that you know, everything you've just described is going to lead our people further into chains. I mean, one thing I've noticed today, I was reading something, it said that 1 in 8 children born today will be registered as disabled. That seems insane to me.
It seems higher. Like that doesn't even seem like it matches what I'm seeing in society. When you say 1 in 8, it feels more like 1 in 4, and it probably will get there. And why? What's this desire people have to be disabled? You're going to get to this, right? It's like like that's your identity. I have this disability. I have this mental illness. This is who I am. Well, there's two things at play there. First of all, it's financially incentivized. You get paid to be disabled. You get paid to have a mental illness. You get full-time care and you get to sit at home and do whatever you want on a government pension. When there's a financial incentive to do something, people try to do it, and people will even lie and say that that's what I am in order to get the money, in order to get the care, in order to get the benefits. The second thing at play is people aren't given any strong sense of identity or personal pride. We don't live in a society that allows national or personal pride to any significant degree. And so people are searching for identity. They're looking for two things. They're looking for money and they're looking for identity. And disabilities, mental health crisis, whatever, mental health issues, they fill both those voids. Yeah. They give them something to identify with. I'm bipolar now. I'm Super Saiyan ADHD depressive disorder. And that sort of is my whole existence. They'll write it in their bios on Instagram or something. That's who they are. They're not Australian. They're not English. They're ADHD bipolar. That's their identity. And like I said, they also need money. Everybody needs money, and they get that from it as well. So this system is rewarding people and giving people identity for being retarded. And so that's why everyone is retarded, because there's incentive, there's reason. It's very easy to understand. The way to stop that is to do the opposite, is to actually incentivize people to be healthy, to take care of themselves, is to reward people who are saying no to the immediate benefits and who are putting in the work to actually live a healthier lifestyle and build something to make themselves self-sufficient. If the government would stop taking the easy route and just exploiting people's base nature and selling them bullshit and convincing them that they're, super anxiety, depressive disorder, so they could sell them drugs, you know, if there was incentive and reason for people to be healthy and strong, if there was a identity that they could plug into, their national identity that they could take pride in, then they wouldn't be searching for drugs and mental health issues to identify with in the first place. Right. So that's the essence of the problem. It's very simple. Like, people are doing what they're paid to do, and they're doing what they feel identity for doing, you know, like this, the sense of identity.
Do you know what though? I think I want to look, we're going to have to do the super chat thing. Not many people are super chatting tonight, especially on Entropy. I don't know if there's a problem there. I've heard they're having problems, or maybe no one wants to donate, one or the other. But like, it has been very sort of, not really anyone has made a donate. Well, we've got one.
Get some super chats in, guys. If you're watching this from Australia, it's too early in Australia for most people to.
Come on, guys. We're having
some super chats in.
If everyone gave a bloody dollar, they wouldn't even notice it, but I'd be very happy.
Give some support to Mark Collett, man. Give some support, guys. Come on.
But look, I need to say.
Let's open our hearts. Let's open our hearts and open our wallets too. Look, ask us a question. Ask me a question. Ask Mark a question. Give us a subject matter and we'll get into it. Let's do it.
But look, this is something I want to say. There's two things I want to say here, Blair. One is I'm a bit of a freak, and I want to admit this, right? When I collect computer games, I like the boxes to be in perfect condition. And if the corner of the box gets dented because I drop it, it upsets me. Now, I wouldn't say I'm mentally ill, okay? I just like my boxes in good condition. I like everything on the wall in the right order, and I like all the boxes to be neat, and I like the labels on the games to be perfect.
I think you need to go to a specialist. This sounds.
But like this is what I mean. Like today, you need medication. but today, a child will be playing in the sandpit, and he'd be like, "I don't want to get my sand in the joint of my Power Ranger because it'll ruin it." And somebody'd be like, "Whoa, have you got ADHD, kid? Better get him a diagnosis." So on one hand, everything today is a mental illness. You like to keep things nice, you're mentally ill. You don't want to do some of the things the other kids want to do. You're mentally ill. You know, you'll
have it's very self-centered, isn't it? Like, you would need to be thinking a lot inwardly about yourself. I've said that before, that mental illness is like the religion of the self. It's like, how can I develop this identity around my own lived experience, my own personal vessel, this vehicle that I'm in? Everything's about me and my special demeanor and my special way of doing things. Here's my bottle of special pills. It has my name on the bottle. See, it's specially for me. Never mind that, you know, 60% of the population is in the exact same frame of mind, living in the exact same bubble, taking the relevant same drugs. It's like, but you're not actually special. You're just doing what everyone else is doing.
It's worse, because the second part of what I was going to say before we do these couple of super chats is, fundamentally, and this is the crazy thing, the parents are proud of it. So when we were kids, if there was something wrong with you, you tried to overcome what was wrong with you, and you didn't want people to know. So if somebody was ill, you know, or somebody had something wrong with them, or it's like, say you were slightly dyslexic, you would go to special classes, you would get special books, you'd do special things to try and overcome it, but you won't wear a big badge saying, I am dyslexic. And then there was a thing that came in where if you were dyslexic, you could have an extra 15 minutes in the examination room because you found it harder to understand the question, so you got a little bit more time. But now you might as well get a special hat, a sparkler, a big badge. And everyone wants the big badge. And I'll tell you this, as a dad who meets other parents, you get parents who come up to you and they boast about the autism or the things that are wrong with their kids. So you will actually have parents who will come up to you and be like, you know, when you know, like kids in the playground, like talk about which Pokemon they've caught. They will talk about their kids' mental illnesses, like their Pokemon, like, got to catch them all. This one's got this. This one's got that. He's got this. He's neurodivergent. And they love it. You know,
they're all waiting to talk about themselves and their own kid. They're not even listening to you. They're all waiting for their turn to talk about their own problems. Imagine living in a community like that. Here's the thing is, Mark, since I was young, I've expressed plenty of qualities of ADHD, as I'm sure you've been told. You've got the same thing, mild autism. Everyone's always said that there's something wrong with me. But I'm just like, even if there is, it's just the way I'm wired, man. I'm not getting into it. I'm not going to get some fucking, pardon my language, some diagnosis. I'm not getting someone to tell me, to categorize me. Humans love to categorize each other, don't they, Mark? You know why they do that? Because it helps them think they understand things. It helps them feel like they've got it figured out when they really don't know shit about anything, especially the experts. All these categories that we develop for different types of people, whether it's ADHD or depression or autism or Asperger's, I'm not saying these things don't exist. There's something going on that makes people, you know, just neurologically different, unique. But developing these word-based categories to make us think that we understand things is a very arrogant human endeavor. We don't actually understand what's going on, and we certainly can't control it with drugs, but we can make money through drugs, and that's what it's all about, guys. But I think this is why so we're talking about this as a problem, but I always like, because I'm a male, Mark's male, so he probably thinks the same thing. I like to think of solutions. I like to just think about, how do we get around this? How do we stop this happening instead of just complaining about it? It's why I've always been in favor of the church making a comeback, a centralized religious institution. You know, I know that these can become pretty corrupt as well, or at least that's what the mainstream media has led us to believe about the church, probably for a subtle reason. They're probably trying to achieve an outcome where the church didn't have as much power anymore because it was a problem. It was a problem for selling junk to people, for selling drugs to people, and for bringing mass amounts of foreigners into your country. The church probably would have stood against that in its old form. So getting rid of the church was a necessary step for whatever this excuse of a country we have now is. But see, when you have a central church that everyone goes to on Sunday, when you have mass or something like that, when you have a religious structure that everyone kind of links into, everyone's Christian, whatever it might be, it doesn't really matter what it is, just as long as everybody agrees that that's the church of the nation. Well, then when someone else comes into your country and says, bipolar disorder, here's my medicine for the cure. You say, no, 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 like we don't do that here. We go to church on Sunday. We talk to the priest if we have a problem. We don't take drugs here. We don't do this ADHD thing. Sorry, mate. You know, so you reject outside identities and efforts to try to sell shit, whether it's pornography, like the church would be against that, whether it's drugs, some other identifying factor that some grifter, some merchant is trying to sell to you. You'll reject it on the basis that you already have a strong identity, a national religious identity. And I think that's what the benefit of having a strong central church was in the beginning. It basically makes people necessarily stubborn. You might say that people being closed-minded as a result of being exposed to too much religious dogma is a bad thing. I would argue against that. I would say it's a good thing because look what open-mindedness has done to our country. Yeah, when people don't have that closed-minded, this is my country, this is my church kind of mentality, then they just become a worm of consumption that accepts and consumes whatever it is that some merchant is trying to sell to them. Suddenly everything and everything just swamps that nation and it just becomes a place for merchants to decimate and exploit. And see, a strong church, I think a big comeback from the church would prevent that. I just don't know if it's possible. I think people would need the ideal situation for a church to make a comeback, actually, or the church to make a comeback, is people suffering, people really suffering. Because when you're suffering, when you've actually got nothing left and you're in a really bad place, that's when you'll find yourself hoping that God's real and hoping that maybe he'll listen. Now, I'm not even religious, guys. I'm not trying to shill Christianity. I'm not trying to shill a religion. I'm just saying that going or reverting back to a time, to a set of circumstances where we had a little bit more faith in something central and something unifying would protect us psychologically from the sort of bullshit ideologies and drugs and mental health crap that is so effectively sold to people today.
Well, look, really quickly before we do the super chats, something you said there, something I said to Adam Green. Me and Adam Green had a bit of a debate the other week. And by the way, David Duke has agreed to debate Adam Green. So we're sorting that out. They're going to have a debate about Christianity, whether it was good for the West or bad for the West. Duke thinks Christianity was good. It was a uniting cause. It helped, you know, Europe beat back Muslim invasions. Adam Green thinks it's basically the biggest evil in the West. That debate's going to happen. But one thing I'll ask you is struggle. You see, I actually like struggle. And I think as a man, without struggle, you are less of a man. And you go to the gym and I go to the gym. I don't know whether you feel this way, but do you ever go to the gym and you work a muscle in a way that you haven't worked it for some time? And the day or so later, you feel sore. But the soreness is kind of a constant reminder that you pushed your limits, that you sort of went to a new level. And I actually like that. I like that sort of feeling that, like, my body is reacting to the pressures I put upon it. And I am part of sort of improving is fighting through that discomfort. That's why I liked running. I like that challenge, that struggle. And I think when you remove struggle from the life, especially of men, not so much women, but especially men, men without struggle do become worthless slobs. And I think the comfort that we have been given by our masters, the bread and circuses, have a lot to answer for in why we are now weak.
That soreness you're talking about, the soreness in the muscles after having done some vigorous exercise, that is a signal that that muscle is regenerating. The cells in that region are regenerating. In order for those cells in the muscle to regenerate, they need a good amount of blood flow and a good amount of oxygen and a good amount of nutrients to come from the GI tract, the gut. And that means the gut needs to work more efficiently in order to feed and repair the muscle. And so the gut does actually start to process and absorb nutrients at a superior rate than it would have if the muscle was not used. What I'm saying is pretty simple to understand. If we're not regenerating, then we're just getting weaker. We're dying. If you're not suffering, to some degree. It's called the fitness effects, and it actually has been applied in a social political sense by an author named David Kilcullen, who's someone that I've read quite a bit. I actually brought him up in the speech that I gave at the conference you hosted, not the last one, but the one before, in the October conference in England. It's called the fitness effect, basically. And with the right amount of pressure, the organism we're talking about, and here we're talking about individual people, your biology, your body gets stronger. It develops itself. And basically, you just become stronger. Everything works better in your body because it has to. You're creating a reason for your body to work more efficiently. So the experience of life becomes better, because the more efficiently the body's working, the happier you're going to feel, the better mood you're going to be in, the better your gut's working, the better you're going to feel. It's very simple. That's why I don't understand how people don't stress their muscles to the bare minimum necessary degree each week, which I think is minimum 3 times per week in the gym for about an hour each time. You know, hitting things like squat, overhead press, deadlift, leg press, major compound movements that are going to stress your body and your central nervous system in a way that your body has to adapt. It's forced to regenerate, and therefore everything starts to turn over more efficiently because it has to in order to regenerate the muscle effectively. So muscle mass actually is one of the, scientifically, one of the greatest determiners of longevity, meaning generally speaking, the more muscle you have, the longer you live. And that ties exactly into what I'm saying, because in order for your body to build and retain more muscle, your cellular regeneration process, your gut, your brain, your nervous system, everything has to fire optimally in order to make that happen. And if you're putting your body under the necessary stress, the bare minimum 3 times a week in the gym, then you're giving your body a reason to have that extra muscle mass, then everything in your body has the reason to operate efficiently. It's like a machine getting greased up, so to speak, but it's much more complex, really, because of our turnover, our cell regeneration system. But yeah, with it, if you're not training, you're dying. You're not getting stronger, you're getting weaker. There's no average existence where you can just sit at and stay healthy. If you just do nothing, you just get fatter and sicker and sadder and weaker gradually. You always have to be exposed to that bare minimum level of stress, which in my view is 3 times a week, 3 hours in the gym, doing the major compound exercises relatively heavy.
Well, thank you. Well, let's do these super chats. Thank you to everyone who has super chatted. There's still plenty of time if you want to. We've had one from Open Borders for Israel for $5. Thank you so much. He said, "Hail Blair, would be good to get him on for a PA Aussie movie night, maybe Rabbit Proof Fence." Yeah, we do movie reviews once a month, and you've not actually been a guest. I don't know if you're a fan of movies, but if you chose a movie, we'd be happy to review it.
Hang on. You guys, you do movie reviews personally?
Yeah.
That'd be awesome. I've done one for, what was it? Culture, Guide to Culture. Do you know Guide to Culture?
I do. I've done every one of his film festivals. So yeah, we do it. We literally do a movie every month. We must have done probably about 50 or 60 movies now.
Maybe my review wasn't so good, but I'll try to find it. I did a review on Good Time with Robert Pattinson. Have you seen that?
No, I've not even heard of that, to be honest.
I reckon write that down, Mark, because I reckon, and you guys in the audience too, it's a very underrated film. It's a very simple plot. It just starts with a bank robbery, but it's set in modern America. And I find it very gritty and realistic. And I find the main character very interesting to psychoanalyze. He's clearly mildly sociopathic, but he's intelligent. And it's very, it's entertaining and fascinating to see how he deals with the degrading circumstances after this bank robbery. So Good Time with Robert Pattinson. I actually really rate Robert Pattinson as an actor.
He's a great actor. He was really good at that.
He was, but he's also talented. He's the kind of guy who can do a lot. He's a musician and he can play different roles. He doesn't always play the same role over and over again. He can play a different character, which I think is a good indication of talent in acting.
I agree. And as I said, I thought he was going to be terrible as a new Batman. And when I saw him as Batman, I thought it was a really enjoyable film. And I was actually looking forward to the sequel. I'm not a guy that usually looks forward to sequels, But yeah, he was good. He was very good. So if you want to choose a movie, Blair, you'd be welcome on any month. All you have to do, choose one, and we will get you booked in.
Is it always movies, or can it be shows? Does it have to be a film?
We'll usually do a film. I've just looked it up. We've reviewed 57 films. It's actually 59 because some have been double features where we reviewed two films together that are both linked. So we did Zulu and Zulu Dawn, and we've also done several comparisons where we've done the original Snow White and the modern Snow White, or we've done the original Running Man and the new
I can imagine there's like a breakdown of modern propaganda.
Yeah. And it's 2 hours long. There's a little panel who are regulars. But look, pick a film, tell me when you're free, and we'll get you booked in. It'd be very good. Purple Sage gave $10, thank you. And he said, thank you both for all you do. Well, thank you so much, my friend. It's very, very kind of you to donate. Kenny Smith gave $10, thank you so much. Said, I'll be fine in any food shortages thanks to my fat stores. All those kebabs will pay off. Thank you. Full Camelot gave $3. Thank you so much. And he said, well, Blair, Victoria is the Garden State. Absolutely. I had a ZD Fairlane V8 dual fuel and regularly travel south to Volcanic Bush and Rock Beach camping. Alone for days, return to society refreshed.
My dad had a Fairlane. I remember when I was 18, I just got my driver's license a couple of weeks prior, and like, I asked my dad if I could borrow the car. I had this date organized with a girl. And my dad said, no, because you're not on the insurance. If you crash it, then, you know, and I said, oh. But then he had two cars, so he went out somewhere. So I took it anyway. Of course, I'm 18. I'm going to take his car anyway. Took his car, went on the date, came back. When I came back, he was home. I got punched in the face for it. So, yeah, it was a tough gig being 18.
Do you know what? I always find it really strange because you meet people that have had a fight with their dad and have been punched in the face by their dad and have fought back. And then you meet other guys and you say, like, have you ever punched your dad in the face? Or have you had a, and they say, no, me and my dad have never had that.
I wouldn't do it. No, I wouldn't do it. My dad's the only person I wouldn't hit back. My dad's only hit me once, actually. It was this car thing. I don't know why.
You've never actually had a fight. Have you ever had a fight with your dad? So you've never actually had a fight?
No, never. No. And my dad's the only bloke that if he hit me, I'd just stand there and take it. I wouldn't hit him back. Never.
Yeah, I don't have that level of restraint. Me and my dad, when I was younger, we have had sort of physical altercations because I was quite wild at times. And, you know, it's not something I'm sort of like mega proud of, but as a young guy, I find it kind of weird when you meet people that have never had any kind of altercation with their dad. I could never understand that because, you know, I often did things where I did deserve a sound whacking. You know, I could do stupid things, but then be quite sort of unrepentant or cheeky.
I got a small funny story I can interject with. Like, my dad and I definitely had some rows. Is that how you say it? Rows or rows?
Rows.
Yeah. We had some disagreements, but we didn't want to hurt each other because my dad, his father, my grandfather, he used to beat the shit out of my dad. So my dad was against hitting me. He didn't want to do that to his son. But, you know, maybe he needed to sometimes because I was a real little shit. But one day he just broke my computer. He broke my computer in a rage because I can't remember the reason I hadn't done something. And he was so frustrated that I hadn't done it that he saw my computer sitting there and it had World of Warcraft sitting there just idle. I'd been playing it and he just broke it. I remember he threw it across the room and it broke. So then I went and took his big sliding saw, expensive Makita sliding saw, out of his shed the next day. And I took it down to the pawnbroker and I swapped it for a new computer. I did a deal with the pawnbroker and then he noticed a week later that his sliding saw was gone. So he came in and sort of, he said, where's my sliding saw? And I said, well, you broke my computer and you didn't pay for it. So it had to be replaced, Dad. That's the way things work. So you know what I mean? Like there was, that's the sort of run-ins that I'd have with my dad.
Well, I can tell you this. I've had physical altercations with my dad and I have fought back as a young guy. But I would never have been bold enough to have taken something of my father's and sell it, because he would have, I think the thrashing at that point, I wouldn't have, as a young man, I never got the better of my dad. I mean, now things are different. Obviously, he's like an older man. So, like, you know, if he got mad with me now, I'm not going to sort of go and sort of give him a good kicking. But as a kid, I did get up to things that I shouldn't have done. And there was a couple of situations where he gave me really sound advice and I didn't take it to sort of my detriment. And it was one of those things where I probably should have listened to him a little bit more when I was younger and being sort of, but when you're young, your head's strong. And although
did your dad try to get you to buy property early?
No, my dad sort of, it's kind of strange because my dad was obviously a big part of my life, but I used to talk to my mum more about decisions that I was going to make. And it was one of those things where I kind of, you know, I was very, very close to my mum, and obviously she passed away a few years and sort of left a big hole in my life. But I was brought up in a world where mum was the stay at home mum. Your dad was out at work nearly all the time. You spent very little time with your dad as a kid, but you spent a lot of time with your mum. And I was, because of that, I was kind of super close with her. And my mum and dad were both really political, but my mum was sort of super uber political. So she loved talking about politics, like, constantly. And that was something where me and her could speak for like an hour or so on the phone about the way the world was, how things were. And so I was just, it's not that I'm not close with my dad, but I was just super close with my mum. So when it came to that kind of advice, I'd take more time talking things through with my mum than my dad, to be honest. Well, who were you sort of closer with? Was it your dad who was the advice giver or your mum?
My dad was a very quiet, hardworking man. He was just always at work. His only day off, he would take me to either track and field athletics or football when I was a kid. And he would volunteer as an umpire. My dad was the kind of guy who showed his affection. He showed his dedication to you through action. He didn't really say, like, I've never hugged my dad, never in my life. That we just didn't have that physical relationship at all. But he would do a lot for me. He would spend his only day off taking me to football and volunteering to help out, that kind of stuff. So he was a, you know, just the strong, silent type sort of thing. And I think he felt like showing me any affection would perhaps portray weakness. And he thought that would be wrong, because he was always trying to demonstrate himself as a strong father, you know, someone to aspire to. And I appreciate that. I understand it. Probably I'll be much the same with my own son. But we'll move on from the dad subject in a sec. What was the last thing I was going to say? The reason my dad used to own property, and he used to tell me that I need to buy property, even if it's a block of land, he said, just buy something, because I was making a lot of money when I was young. Because thanks to my dad as well, he got me various jobs with big building companies. I was a supervisor for a building company when I was only 18 somehow. All the other supervisors were like 50-year-old builders and carpenters. And here I am playing a supervisory role thanks to my dad. My dad's like, buy property, mate. Take some of this money you're making and put it into property. Your future self will thank you for it. But because my dad was always so stressed and broke, I thought, the old prick just wants him. He just wants me to be miserable like him. He's just pissed off that I've got money, so I'm not going to listen to him. And I'm thinking to myself, you idiot. You idiot. If I did buy property when I was young, I'd be in a position right now where I wouldn't even have to work full time. But because I didn't listen, yeah. But that's just classic hindsight.
Well, my dad, you know, he's a very, very good man, and he is a nationalist. But sort of his sort of era of man was a man that, you know, didn't spend a huge amount of time with the family. You spent time with him on a Sunday, maybe a little bit on a Saturday. But dads of that era were always at work. They were always doing everything, and they showed their love for their family by providing. This is an odd thing, because today everyone's sort of programmed that your dad shows love for you with loads of hugs and doing everything with you. But back then, the dads were, and more or less every dad, all my friends' dads were the same. They were always out at work. They were up super early. They went out to work. They brought home
You respected him, right? You wouldn't act up when dad was around, because you respected him, and you kind of feed him a little bit too in a healthy way. When it was just mom, you knew you could get away with a bit more. knew you could act up a little bit, you could eat a little bit extra, if you could sneak stuff out of the cup, whatever. But when dad was around, you didn't act up because you didn't give your dad any shit. You respected your dad.
Yeah. And not only that, but like, because you knew how hard your dad worked, when he was in the house, you wouldn't be raucous. Like if it was just your mum around and you had your friends over, or you were fighting with your sister, you knew that was kind of all right, because mum sort of put up with that because she was there to sort of oversee you as kids, and that was her day job. So sod it, I'm going to make noise and be a bit crazy. But if your dad came in and you had a long day at work, there was no jumping on the sofa, there was no hooting and hollering and chucking things about, you were respectful, you cleaned up your toys, you did your best, because you knew that dad had had, and your mum would be like, don't you be doing this when your dad comes home, because he's been out since, you know, 7:30 this morning, he's had a long day, and you know, when he comes in, he doesn't want you to be playing hell. He wants to come into a respectful family. And I think, you know, these things are largely gone now. You know,
it's a shame.
The idea.
That dynamic was essential for my upbringing, really, I think. Like, my mum could say 1,000 words to me and get no result trying to get me to do something. But my dad just had to speak once to say a few words and I would do it straight away.
Yeah.
And not have it. Like, I fear the person I might have become if I didn't have my dad in my life. I probably would have become a much more relentless criminal, because I feared my dad. That kept me, you know, it had some sort of influence over me, which was positive.
Yeah, I agree. Similar with me. The resident baker gave $20. Thank you so much. And said, evening, Mark, I was going to give some money to charity for some new Jewish ambulances. However, I've reconsidered because I don't really like Jewish ambulances, and you're a much more worthy cause. Thank you so much. I've got a video coming out at the weekend about the Jewish ambulances, so look out for that. That's the end of the Entropy Super Chats. We're going to go over to Rumble now. Come on, guys. The Entropy fans, where were you tonight? The Bearded Indian gave $8. Thank you so much. And said, Blair, have you ever brought bread from a man in Brussels who was 6'4" and full of muscles? Big love, praying for Joel and the political prisoners. I get that. I love that song. And you could be the man in Brussels who was also a man from down under, if you listen to the song.
I think there's a sad story behind that song, actually. I won't tell it because I don't know it, but I'm pretty sure that song... Or maybe it's not that song, but there's a stereotypical iconic Australian song that was actually stolen from someone and they lost the rights to it and stuff like that. But anyway, I understand the pun, so I appreciate it.
One of the sad things about Men at Work, the guys who did it, they all sort of fell out with each other. And the original lineup of Men at Work, they're not all sort of still together. And I don't think they actually speak to each other, which is really, really sad. So now there is only one member of Men at Work left, which is the main guy, Colin Hay. But all of the other guys and the ones who came up with the iconic songs, they've all left. And I find that quite sad, because it'd be nice if, like, after all this time, they were still playing gigs together. But no, it's just the...
It's weird how people... To me, it's always weird how people fall out. I've never fully fallen out with anyone. You know, people have done things that upset me and haven't done the right thing by me always, but I still like to think about the good times I have with those people. So I never really fall out with anyone. Like, when I call someone my friend, it's like a lifelong thing for me. But I suppose, you know, things happen to some people that are bad enough that, you know, bridges are burned. I just try not to burn bridges personally.
I think in the musical world, it's a common thing, because I think you're stuck together with people when you're touring. You're always with them. And then often people have different ideas of where they want their band or their group to go. And I think it's a very different world. I think that's a commonplace thing. Bodder Nielsen gave 3 gifted subscriptions. Thank you so much. If you get a gifted subscription, please do keep it up. It's very
important. What is a gifted subscription? Is that like a...
On Rumble, you can gift subscriptions that anyone can claim, and then they can keep them going if they want. So the idea is that you get paid subscribers. So say I had 200 paid subscribers at $5 a month from each one. It just gets you, you know, you get, that means you're going to get $1,000 American every month, less the processing fee. And it's just, obviously everyone's dream is to get to the point where as a content creator, rather than having to sort of hope and pray for super chats, you end up getting the other stuff where people just give. And that's the key thing. Like, if you're on some kind of thing where everyone, you know, 1,000 of your supporters gave you $5 a month at the beginning of every month, you don't have to worry and you don't have to do super chats. You know what I mean? It's just one of the sort of things of how it works, basically. But thank you for giving the gifted subs. And if you do get a gifted sub, please maintain it, because it means a lot to me. So thank you so much. Serena JB gave $8. Thank you so much. And said, love to all our fellow nationalists in Australia, especially to Joel. Well, thank you very much. Purple Sage gave $10. And thank you. And said, thank you both for all you do. Well, thank you so much. Ayn Cheruska gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, hail to you, Mark and Blair. Powerful show and powerful takes. Struggle is the father of all things. Well, I agree. Hazelnut 3000 gave $10. Thank you. And said, thank you, Mark and Blair. Do you know, this is just a little an aside here, but I remember reading about the butterfly, and basically butterflies struggle coming out of their cocoon. But if you cut the cocoon open and you help the butterfly out, it basically retards the butterfly and it can't then operate. The butterfly needs that struggle in order to get out. Conversely, it's different for chickens coming out of eggs. If you are hatching chickens and you don't wet the eggs and soften them, the chickens actually do need a hand getting out of the eggs. They die.
There's so much balance to be considered in these things. And I think the female role in this process is to empathize with the creature in the immediate sense. And the masculine role is to empathize with the broader implications of what you're doing in the moment. So women will always, or the more feminine creatures or people, they'll always try to help the person in the moment, make the person feel good in the moment. And that's the way feminine empathy is expressed, whereas male empathy will be allow whatever it is to figure it out for itself and interfere not so much in the moment in order that things are stronger and more developed in a broader sense, more of a, you know, survival of the fittest type thing. That's like masculine altruism, you might say, whereas the feminine altruism is much more immediate. But I think having a balance of those things, because they're both very natural expressions, aren't they? It's like one isn't bad or worse than the other. I think when you go one way too far, like modern society has gone way too far to the feminine, well, then you end up with a weak and sickly society because everyone gets cared for in the moment too much. They get what they want in the moment, what they feel like. They get validated too much for not really doing anything of value. So I think in future, as Tom Sewell would say, when we take this country, when we take control, when we take power, we need to strike a really appropriate balance between those two forces. We need to maintain it and really prevent things from going too far one way or the other.
Thank you. The Bearded Indian gave $6. Thank you so much. He said, the Trump or the police aren't victims because they're being misled. They are self-serving pigs who will step on anyone to keep their snout in the trough. They know exactly what they're doing. Well, thank you so much. Iggs22 gave $5. Thank you so much. And he said, I stayed with an Italian family in Lima, Peru. Both sons, 40, live at home with partners. They pool resources and own 4 successful businesses. Should we teach our kids to build wealth as a family unit? Well, that's a very interesting question. My answer to that would be, I would love my children to grow up near me and have a relationship with them longer and later in life. I moved away from where my parents are. But I do also think it's important for people to have space. So, for example, you know, if my daughter met a nice guy and they wanted to settle down, I would want to help them get their own house. I'd want them to help them settle down so they have their own space, because I don't think you can truly flourish as a young couple if you're living under the roof of one of your parents. So I do understand that people in some cultures have these large family gatherings under one roof, but I think as a young couple it's nice to have your own space and to be able to branch out a little bit. It's nice to have the parents there and the extended family close, but too close I think can be stifling. What do you think, Blair?
Yeah, you don't want to live under the same roof as like too many different families, extended family, friends. living under the same roof with friends is actually the fastest way to ruin relationships with friends, because you get to see what your friend is actually like most of the time. Like, cracks start to appear, laziness, stuff like that. And it's really problematic for ongoing friendships. And even living with family sometimes, like, people like end up really disliking their own siblings if they spend too much time too close to each other. So everyone needs their space. That's why we all go to our own bedrooms at the end of the day. So even if you're living in a community-based environment, everyone having their own space, like, even if it's on the same property, you have different little houses on the same property that you can go to, and you still have your room, your office, your bedroom you can retreat to at the end of the day. I think that's really important, especially important for me. I like to spend a long periods of time alone. Actually, people close to me say they don't know anyone. They've said that. They don't know anyone who needs as much time to himself as I do. So it's really important for some people. It's just a necessary facet of the human condition, I think.
I completely agree. I like time on my own, and I don't understand people who always have to be.
I watched a video recently. The 10 things like intelligent people do or something. And I watched it because I thought, I want to see if I do any of these things. Now, I'm not going to brag and tell you how many of the things I ended up doing, but the one thing that surprised me was talking to yourself. One of the things apparently intelligent people do is they talk to themselves. And I'm thinking, that like blew my mind when that one popped up on the screen, because I thought, I've been doing that since I was a kid a lot. I've been waiting for no one to be in the house so I can pace the hallway and discuss things with myself. And I'm wondering, do you do that, Mark?
Oh, God, I'm laughing because I do. And the worst thing is the missus will like come into the house and I won't hear her coming in. And I'll be in sort of like conversation. She's like, who are you talking to earlier? And I was just like, just myself. I was running through a few ideas and doing a back and forth. And my sort of inner monologue was coming out. And I do this when I'm running as well. I used to go on long runs on a Sunday morning, and I'd have a conversation about ideas. And if I'm planning out a speech or something like that, I will do it and run through it under my breath. And sometimes I walk past people in the street and they'll be looking at me like, he's talking to him. But you speak to some people and you'll be like, that's just my inner monologue. And they're like, what's one of them? And you'll be like, what do you mean? So you don't have conversations with yourself about ideas and plans, and you don't have a back and forth, and they're like, no.
We'll get to the point where they're planting microphones in your house and you'll be committing hate speech to yourself. Yeah. And you'll get charged for hate speech to yourself, Mark. You've got to be careful.
But I do it all the time, and it sometimes frustrates and freaks people out. And sometimes, as I say, the missus will come up and says, who are you talking to? Your phone wasn't even... Yeah, well, that's just me. And it really annoys her if I say, it's the best conversation I get in this house, which is like, that's the best. If you want to start a real argument, is when your missus catches you having the inner monologue, reminder that it's more intelligent conversation than you get out of her. And then you will get that. That is the fast track to being punched by your partner. All good. How's it going? Gave $2. Thank you so much. Said, hail Mark, hail Blair. If you could both meet up IRL in each other's countries, where is the first place you would go to showcase your homeland? I'm glad you're still alive and well, Blair. Well, I didn't actually get to do as much with Blair as I do with usually when people come over, and it's because Blair arrived. I sort of met him. Then he had to go and do things with his partner, and they went on little exploratory journeys themselves. But if I could have taken Blair anywhere, it would have been to a place called Bradgate Park in Leicestershire, which has got historic ruins, wild running deer, and some of the oldest trees in the whole country. Like these trees, some of them are 700-800 years old. So the things they've seen in their lifetime is just incredible. You know, they really are these incredible sort of, they're not obviously alive in the sense of like a creature, but living entities that have seen changes over their lifetime that, you know, we couldn't imagine. And I think that connection with nature to me is important. It's a place I went as a child, and sharing that with somebody like Blair would have been awesome. But unfortunately, we didn't get as much time together as I hoped.
When I was a kid, I used to wish that I could touch an old tree and absorb its knowledge. I used to imagine that was happening if I touched an old tree, but I'm kind of torn. I want to take Mark. I would take Mark to the Shrine of Remembrance in Melbourne and explain, like, exactly the significance of all the different features, because it's very significant, not just to Australians, but to I think all extended members of our race. I've learned that only recently, actually, in the past few years. But then I also want to take Mark to the athletics track, the track and field institution set up that I used to compete on when I was younger. And I want to see if I can beat him in a 200-meter or 100-meter foot race. That's what I'd really want to do.
Mate, I'm an old man now. I'm 45. And one thing I've noticed as I get older, I don't seem to get that much weaker. So I can still go to the gym and do decent lifts and build myself up. But that burst energy where you can, not long distance, you can still do, you get a lot of long distance runners who are old men, but that burst energy you have when you're young is just gone. So you might beat me there. Spartan Sadakar gave $2. Thank you so much. Said, my view is this planet needs a moral, wise, compassionate white emperor that has legally restrained authority over every single military and space travel, peace by centralization and strict laws of war. Well, thank you so much. Ironically, I made a joke earlier privately to Blair that he would make an excellent sort of Conan the King style character that could rule by a compassionate force. I actually said that to you earlier, didn't I? There's something I actually said to you. So would you take on the role of Conan the King?
I remember. And the reason Mark said that is because I said the picture he used in the backdrop for this screen, the picture of me, I hadn't seen that picture before, I don't think. And I thought, when I saw it, I thought I look like a junior Bill Gates.
Yes, you have seen. It's the picture me and you had together at the conference.
Is it? Okay, right. But it's like I look like a junior Bill Gates, like a psycho banker or something who wants to take over the world. And I said, I promise, Mark, I don't want to take over the world. And he said to me, you know what? You can't. You probably should.
Well, I always see... apparently, the Arnold Schwarzenegger Conan franchise was meant to run for about 10 films. And the final one was meant to be called Conan the King, where you had an old Schwarzenegger sat atop a throne, worn out, old, but proud of everything he'd built and created. And I always sort of thought of that as like the great white ruler that united his people, conquered everything and died, you know, still on top, a very rare ideal because most leaders don't make it that far. But I think you'd be a worthy man, or everything could go to hell and you could be kind of like the great Humongous in like a Mad Max world.
Whatever works, as long as I'm getting what I need and as long as I've got my boys with me, I'm happy.
Good. The Shogun gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, feels surreal that we have the honor of witnessing two heroes of the white race live on screen and can send $5, but just don't. Well, thank you so much. And you did. Baba2 gave $50. Thank you so much for your generosity. And he said, white American proud national socialist here showing my support for you both. Hail our folk, hoping tomorrow brings freedom for Joel. Well, so do I. Thank you so much. And if he can come on a stream soon, I'd love to do a special with him to talk about his time in jail. How's it going? Gave $5. Thank you so much. And he said, for Blair and Mark, I was in a car accident 3 years ago. I'm sorry to hear that. And haven't had the motivation to get back in the gym. Any ideas or motivation you could send my way? Hail Mark and Blair, free Joel. Well, sometimes car accidents can have a massive effect on you, a big accident. So I hope you get out of the place you're in mentally. But I think sometimes when you have sort of a trauma, it can affect you in other ways. And my best advice for anybody, and this is what my dad always used to say, most people who fail to get where they want to be fail because tomorrow is always the start date for every single project, but tomorrow never comes. Tomorrow is always, I'm always going to start tomorrow. Now I'll start at the beginning of next month. I'm going to start when we get to summer. Next year, 1st of January, I'll start. Had a heavy night last night. Starting the first new week in January. There's always an excuse. Today has to be the day. And it takes real mental will and iron and steel in your heart to do that. And to me, if you want to get down to the gym, don't plan it. one day, just get up and do it. There is no plan. Just do it. That's got to be the way, and commit to it. I used to do this on a Sunday morning. I used to run 10K every Sunday morning before I had the kids. And I'll tell you this, there's always a good excuse every Sunday morning not to get out of bed at 6 a.m. and run 10K. But if you don't do it, you feel like an absolute piece of crap for the rest of the day. If you do it, you feel fantastic and you're glad you did it.
Yeah, I would not be so enthusiastic about life if I didn't lift weights in the gym. I feel like it helps me cope, really. It's like my medicine, right? It's like my therapy and my medicine at the same time. So am I not going to take my medicine? Of course not. I'm going to take my medicine, but I don't actually take any pills. I just go to the gym. That's my medicine. It makes me feel better. It makes me feel like nothing else really compares to the pain I just experienced in there. So then everything else is easy compared to that. That's part of it, but I agree with Mark. Sometimes you just got to do whatever it is that you want to do in the moment, or an idea that you've got, something you want to try. You put it into practice immediately, because you have to understand, as a human, you need to know your limits as a human. You need to understand the human condition. You're lazy. You're lazy and you're habit prone. So the only way you're going to break the habit is to just immediately break it. As soon as you get an idea in your head of how to break it, put it into action straight away. Literally drive to the gym, join it, and go in there with your bag and your towel in the bag, your singlet on, and just do a workout, see what you come up with. If you don't know how to work out, look it up on YouTube or watch what the other guys in the gym are doing and copy them. Sit on some machines and just see how they move, see how they work. Just taking that first step of getting out of your comfort zone and breaking the habit, that's like 50% of the work. Trust me, that's, you're halfway there already once you've broken the habit. And if you've been in a car accident, you've sustained some relatively serious injuries, there's a good chance you could still be taking opioids. Like people get into a habit of taking the Panadeine Forte or the Tramadol or whatever it is that they get put on. And then 2 years later, after a broken leg or a crushed pelvis in a car accident, they're completely healed, but they're still taking the opioids because the body's developed a mild dependency on the drug. And the medical institutions love that, because they can keep selling you the drug indefinitely and telling you that you need it, and you feel like you need it. Your brain thinks it does. Swap out that medicine or whatever else it is that you're doing to cope with life, drinking, eating sugar. I guarantee you've got some cope, even smoking cigarettes. Swap that out for the gym. Make the gym your cope. Make the gym your medicine, your therapy. Your body will reward you for it, believe me.
Thank you. I'm Trust, Son of Wessex is now a monthly supporter. Thank you so much. I'm Trust, you gave $5. Thank you so much. Said Blair, I find your Telegram videos on weightlifting useful, and the same goes for your posts on various topics. As for our enemies, their rotten bones are trembling. Defeat never, victory forever. Well, thank you so much. Ranulph White Wolf 11 gave $5. Thank you so much. Said one of my English students here has been having me read a Jewish book about how all races are just as smart and whites advanced because of farming. Any thoughts on attempts to modernize the Aborigines? Well, look, I would say this. Anyone that says all races are equally smart is by nature a fraud. Farming is a result of intelligence, but it's also a result of being able to defer pleasure and to plan. And that is a function of intelligence. People who are not very intelligent can't defer pleasure. It's like the trick which you do. Well, not a trick. It's like a little game you do with your children. Say, would you like one chocolate egg now or two chocolate eggs in 10 minutes? And the child that isn't very smart will take the egg immediately, but won't understand that waiting and having patience is a good thing. And you tend to find this with certain racial groups, that if you say to them, would you like £10 now or £100 in, you know, a day's time, they'll take the £10, go and spend it. And in a few days' time, you won't even remember what really happened. Whereas intelligent people will genuinely defer. It's why more intelligent people sort of save their money rather than just spending it. So they plan for the future, whereas people who are very impulsive and have low impulse control, who are less intelligent, they get themselves into financial bother because they can't work it out. And it's why white people who aren't as intelligent are preyed upon so heavily by financial institutions, because the financial institutions know that if they dangle the carrot of have the car now, but pay stupidly high amounts for repayments on finance, less intelligent people will always fall for that. And it's why our ancestors had such strong laws against usury and against, coercive forms of finance and money lending, because they knew that more vulnerable people in society would get in sort of permanently in debt to the money lenders.
Whoever said that, by the way, that all races are equally intelligent and white people just did better because of farming, they're worse than, Marx said that person's obviously a fraud. It's worse than fraudulent. They're probably hostile, laying the groundwork for racial equality so they can open your borders or contribute to your tolerance of open borders, which leads to your own ethnic replacement. The whole idea that white people just use some kind of cheat code, that everyone's the same and white people cheated. See, when you start believing in racial equality and the equality of all people, then the only way one race or ethnic group of people could be doing better in terms of creativity and civilization, the only way that you can make sense of that, if you believe in equality, is, well, they must have cheated. And so then your feeling, your objective in life, is basically centered around bringing that race down because they've cheated. They're not allowed to be better because them being better conflicts with my idea about racial equality. And if the races are equal, then they need to be made equal, not by lifting up the lesser, but by dragging down the ones that cheated, the better ones, because the only way they could be better is if they cheated. Or people like that could rethink their worldview and just acknowledge basic reality that the races aren't equal. Look, there's plenty of low IQ white people. Not all white people are creative geniuses or intelligent. We have plenty of white people out there that have the intelligence of somebody from Africa. There's plenty of them. But on average, white people tend to be slightly more intelligent or higher IQ than people from Africa. There's a mean to consider there. And like, you know, as you suggested just then, Mark, in this case, the chicken came before the egg. Like, you don't farm, you don't put any effort into preparing a system of resources for the future unless you already have the intelligence to do so in the beginning, unless you have the foresight, which is related to intelligence. So, like, one of the worst things you can do for yourself is believe in human equality, specifically human racial equality, because it's going to make you very angry. You're going to be very angry downstream from that viewpoint, because you're going to expect that everyone should and can perform equally when they obviously can't. And you're going to become very frustrated with everybody because what they're actually doing and the way they're performing does not reflect the preconceived idea of equality that you've been sold and you've invested yourself into. So if you are watching this and you tend towards that equality stuff, if you're a leftist, if you're a cop working for the system, they probably watch this stuff. Take a step back, because human equality is not real and it's going to piss you off. And you're going to spend a lot of time trying to cope and enforce something that doesn't exist. So, like, trust me, life, when you realize people aren't equal, you become more forgiving. You become a little more forgiving of the average person who can't move at the same pace as the others. You actually have more empathy, in my opinion, when you don't believe in human equality. But I won't get into that. I won't discuss that anymore. I'll just say that believing in equality is not just wrong, it's going to make your life more difficult.
Certainly is. How's it going? Gave $2. Thank you so much. So deciding on the right food to eat is my big issue, or my biggest issue, he says. I don't know how to cook really well. Do you guys have any go-to easy, healthy meals? Thank you. Yeah, I do. I'll give you mine very quickly. I make smash burgers at home. They're really, really easy to make. You just get two balls of ground beef that weigh around to your taste. I always do it at 60 grams. I get the 60 gram balls of ground beef. I've got a burger smasher. I smash them into a really low frying pan. I haven't actually got a skillet. I make them. I top them with cheese, put them in a brioche bun. I load it up with things that I like, lettuce, onion, tomato. There's a really good protein content there. I either eat one of those or two of those if I fancy four burger patties. So somewhere between 60 and 120 grams of 5% fat minced beef. So it's the higher protein minced beef. These are very cheap, much cheaper and much healthier than buying sort of one at McDonald's. You can buy the ground beef in bulk. You get your mayonnaise, your sauces in bulk. The cheese is really cheap. You buy your brioche buns really cheap in bulk. They don't go off either. They've got about a 30-day shelf life because of the sugar content. They're not like normal bread. I could eat those all day. In fact, I made those for tea for the whole family tonight because they like them too. I've been to the gym today and I get a lot out of eating like that. I also enjoy things like steak, but that's a lot more expensive. So I go for the ground beef option and I make my own burgers and they're very healthy. There's no added ingredients. It is just the ground beef in the pan with the burger smasher.
Eight eggs. Eight good eggs. Eggs you can get in bulk pretty cheap if you can find like a farm or regional source, local source. You can get them in trays of 30. If you're going to cook them, you want to just crack them all into the pan, scramble them up, throw in some onion and some garlic. If you're going to drink them raw, which you can also do, just do it one at a time and don't break the yolk, because when you break the yolk, if you're drinking an egg, you get like a fat, salty taste, which can make some people gag. But if the egg just – like drinking eggs is actually fine in my opinion. I've drank hundreds of eggs because I haven't had the time to cook them. I've done it as like a quick snack. In my life, I haven't drank hundreds of eggs in one sitting, but in my life, I've drank hundreds and I've been fine. So yeah, if my go-to snack, it's easy, eight eggs, eight good eggs.
Blair, I've done the egg thing. I like them scrambled, but I add to mine a little bit of ham and some kind of chili sauce. I like a bit of like really hot chili sauce in the pan, scrambled. I have ham and that. I've never tried the garlic, but yeah, I've done that as well in the morning. So I've done the eggs in the morning, the smash burgers for lunch, whatever I get cooked for my evening meal. And then before bed, a big whey protein shake. So I'm sleeping on the protein. But the eggs are really good as well.
Careful, there's no vegetable oil in that sweet chili sauce. It'll make you gay.
Well, I mean, I'm doing pretty well already. Two kids, you know, obviously not doing the homo thing yet, but to be honest, do you know what got me into the thing? Me and my missus don't really buy each other presents for Christmas and things. It's just a waste of money. We got most things we need, but we buy each other sort of silly things. And one year she bought me the complete collection of like chilies, and it started off with like, I'm a big fanny, anyone could drink this with, if you drink this you're gonna die. And she was like, are we gonna do that? If we drink this you're gonna die. And I was like, yeah. She had a little bit and she was like, this is fine. I'm like, you're being a complete freak. Let's get some of this down. Oh my God, I did nearly die. I can tell you, my eyes were watering. My nose was, it was one of the top three chilies in the world, sort of condensed into a sauce. And I thought I could just tank it. And boy, did I regret it. I don't put that on my eggs, I can tell you.
Someone is wondering if oil, like vegetable oil, does make you gay the way sugar does. I don't know. You've just got to assume the worst with this stuff, guys. And hey, it makes you weaker and sicker. So, you know, gay, weak, sick, it's all the same, isn't it?
Look, I'll say this. Do you know what? I actually spend less time worrying about what's in food and more time worrying about what's in non-prescription and prescription drugs. And one of the things that I think really weakens men is this cannabis addiction. Everyone's smoking cannabis.
I smell marijuana in England quite frequently, and I don't smell it as much here, I got to say. It might be a thing there, or maybe it is a thing here too. I don't know. But, yeah, it's not very popular among the right-wing or nationalist community down here in Australia, not that I know of. There's actually some staunch opinions against it.
Everyone does it here, and I think it's going to have real mental problems for people in the future. Baba 2 gave $20. Thank you for your continued support. It's good to be in solidarity with like men with men like you two. Looking forward to the Duke Green debate. I'm a Green supporter, but also a Duke supporter. I'm 61 and still work out hard. Well, well done. And he said, just join Nova now. I would really like to talk to the Nova people. They reached out to me by email. I replied and they never got back to me. I offered them a show to discuss what they do. If anyone from Nova wants to do that as a Sunday or Friday night special, I'd be interested in doing that. Ulrich Rangel gave $3. Thank you so much. Said Mark and Blair, would be good to see Jacob Herson on PWR to complete the Aussie guys. He's already been on. Blair, does he do interviews? Yes, he does. And Mark, could you be his long lost Aussie brother? Yes, I could. He's been on before. He's welcome to come on again. Phoenix National gave $3 and said, great stream. Well, thank you so much. Santandex gave $21. Thank you so much and said, hi, Mark and Blair. I'm currently trying to organize whites in my area by putting up flyers and stickers with a link to my Telegram. Just wondering if either of you have any advice for other ways also. And he said, by the way, I'm in Australia. I think the best thing in Australia, personally, with the new laws coming in, is to build sort of informal networks so it's not a codified group. I mean, what do you think, Blair?
I think the guys are trying to figure it out. Everybody's trying to figure it out. It's one of those situations where you're forced to adapt new strategy, obviously. And a new strategy will be adapted. There's been, you know, the boys are converging. I don't even know. I don't know. At this point, it's all so fresh that it's something that's being discussed amongst different groups and people. Like, I don't know. There's still groups. There's still activist groups that exist. They just don't do a lot of activism right now as a result of how much heat there is on activists from our side of politics. It's basically, it's almost illegal to be a nationalist in Australia right now. It's basically illegal depending on how you express that nationalism or whether you express it at all. It's almost like you're supposed to, if you want to be nationalist, you have to be nationalists quietly at home, but you can't talk about it in public. That's the point we're pretty much at in Australia. So how do you actually adapt to that? That's yet to be determined.
Thank you. Ulrich Rangel gave another $3. Thank you so much. Said, Mark, after the successful show with the Angry Bootnik, who is next on your hit list of converting to our side? Can I suggest a normie channel called Dino Bane? He reminds me of the old Iconoclast. Look, I'll chat to any of these people. I'm very, very welcoming to people. If Dino Bane, I've heard of him. If he wants to come on my channel and talk about ethno-nationalism, reach out to him. The invite's there. Dino Bane, let's talk. Yvonne626 gave $25. Thank you so much. So I want to give money, but I want to ask something. All my thoughts are Fed posty. Okay, here. Everyone should build an underground cache of creatine and wait for a chance to distribute it to right-wing friends. That's not a question. How about agree, disagree, that creatine cache must be underground and have a hidden entrance so the satellite eyes in the sky are blind to it? I use creatine. Do you know what? I thought creatine was a lie at first. I thought nothing could have that sort of instant positive effect. But I find if I take the creatine, it boosts my lifts by about 8 to 10%. And if I don't take it, I am noticeably weaker and less pumped. Do you use creatine?
It's pretty specific, Mark. It boosts your lifts by about 8 to 10%, by about 8.7 or 10.3%, roughly in between that region. I'm not really – yeah, I do use creatine on occasion, and it does work. It's one of the more studied substances or compounds, and it's typically derived from red meat. So if you have a diet that's high in red meat, you'll probably get enough creatine naturally, but it is a good idea to load it up with a supplement just so you're not having to eat 17 steaks a week because it's not really financially viable in this economy. But there's all sorts of evidence available suggesting that it's great for mental health, cognitive function, fertility, even in women. So creatine is almost like a very important building block for general health. You want to look into that too, guys, if you have the time, and look at investing in a creatine supplement. I personally find it increases my stamina working out. I can always do extra reps with heavier weight after I have 5 to 10 grams of creatine, usually an hour before I work out. It can also be viable to have it after your workout to replenish, or because your muscle cells are really open after a workout. Your your sensitivity to absorb nutrients is greater. So the creatine can get back in and sort of volumize your muscle cells and assist with the recovery as well.
I also find with the creatine, it's one of the cheaper supplements as well. You can get 100% pure creatine, very, very cheap. Like some of these things are quite expensive. It's cheap, it's effective. Get it, guys. Ranulf White Wolf 11 gave $4. Thank you so much. And he said, Jared Diamond in Guns, Germs and Steel. Obviously, Diamond is an anti-white Jew. Well, thank you so much. How It's Going gave $1. Thank you very much. And he said, thank you guys so much for the wisdom and encouragement. Mark and Blair are the greatest of all time. Well, thank you so much. We do our best. Ranulf White Wolf gave another $2. Thank you so much. And said, back when I lived in South Korea, I would drink red ginseng before working out. And I found that raised my failure threshold. Yeah, there are natural things that I've, a lot of people swore by that. I believe that the famous Olympic runner, Linford Christie, used ginseng tea. Solar Mask gave $20. Thank you so much. So thanks, fellas. Great show as usual. And Sally gave $5. Thank you so much. And thank you, Mark and Blair. And Scaredy Cat gave $8 and said, hi, Blair, Mark. Right now, our stage of politics is all humanity being ruled by the Jewish community and its allies, the Christian Zionists and the Muslim Zionists. Planet Earth's 200 countries are one by one being converted to a single corporate terms of service world ruled by hate crime legislation. Well, thank you so much. And that is very true. And I believe one of the reasons that they will go at or have gone after Iran is because it's one of the countries or one of the few countries that does not have a central banking system owned by the Rothschilds. Anyway, we've done a half an hour more than we were expecting. And thank you for everyone who chipped in tonight. It's really, really appreciated. But thanks most to Blair. It's been an amazing stream. You know, Blair, it's really weird because I just want to say this. Firstly, a massive thank you for sticking around for an extra 25 minutes. But look, also, you're one of the few people, like I actually had a plan for this show and it largely went out the window. And you're one of the few people who, when I do a show, I don't need to stick to the show notes. I kind of feel that we could sort of do a 4 or 5 hour show where we were just talking about random things. And it would probably be more entertaining than the usual structured, you know, 20 minute show followed by an hour of questions. You are a very versatile guy and your takes tonight have been absolutely fantastic. But thank you for being here. And as always, please do have the last word and then we'll shut things down.
Likewise, mate. Yeah, I enjoy the shows. I look forward to when you ask me to come on, to be honest. Whenever you say, hey, you're free this week, I'm just like, hey, that'll be fun. And I actually, you know, I tell my mates about it. I'm going on with Mark this week. So yeah, I enjoy it as well. I find the conversation flows quite naturally. And you're an inquisitive guy. You're a curious guy, and you're always curious to discuss things, which I appreciate. And yeah, it is good to not have to stick always too rigidly to the same basic political talking points, because you can go down a pretty extensive rabbit hole with that stuff, and you still need to keep yourself understandable. It's just more entertaining, I think, and it's more enjoyable when you can discuss things that are a little bit more relatable to the standard person, a little bit more human sometimes. So, yeah, I feel the same, and I appreciate it. Thanks for the invite. It's been a good show. We probably could have discussed the whole Trump-Iran situation a little more in-depth. I do have more feelings about that, more thoughts about that, but I'm sure that there's so much of that going on the internet. I don't feel we need to contribute any more to it now that I think about it.
Well, Blair, like, I really enjoy having you on, and I do have sort of a rotation of guests. And to be fair, like, I always feel bad calling on you personally because you have to get up early in the morning. But if you're willing to, I would happily have you on, you know, quarterly, once every 3 months as a regular recurring guest, because it always is such a good show. And to hear that you enjoy coming on, I will ask you more often. But I always felt I was a bit of an inconvenience or potentially a pain in the ass because, you know, for you, it's like the early morning show. And some people, it doesn't work. Whereas when you invited me on your show, it was always the best thing ever because you always invited me on and you're like, oh, it's late night in Australia. But it was like 10 a.m. here, which was absolutely brilliant for me because I've just got up, just necked the first energy drink, and I'm sort of feeling as if I can take on the world, whereas for you it's a bit early. But thank you so much. It's been amazing, and I will get you on more often. Thank you also to everyone who donated so generously. Everyone was super generous through Rumble tonight, so thank you so much. I don't know what was going on with Entropy, and I'm not saying this because I'm asking for more Entropy donations, but if there is a problem with Entropy, I've had a few reports of issues, and Henrik was having an issue. So if there is an issue with that platform, please let me know so I can feed it back to the developers, because, you know, that is important. And Henrik was talking about that last time I was on his show. Anyway, thank you also to everyone who tuned in. So thank you to Blair. Thank you to everyone who donated so generously. And thank you to everyone who was watching live. We were quite high up and boosted on Rumble tonight in the trending news thing. We're on the front page of the trending live stream. So thank you to everyone who got us there. I'll be back later in the week with a pre-recorded video. I'm doing some more streams. Keep an eye on Telegram for those. And I'll be back next week with Steve Laws for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. And if you want to donate when I'm offline, please do so. So if you're one of those people watching on replay, you can give then. Anyway, thank you so much. See you next week. Good night, everyone. I appreciate your support. Love you all.